Place to Be Nation, welcome to this week's Place to Be Podcast Classic episode. I'm your co-host, Just Rosero. Joining me as always, my PIC, Scott Griscolo. And Scott, WrestleMania 33 is in the books. It's officially over. And we're entering that post-WrestleMania season lull. But you know what? We're not killing things off just yet here on the Place to Be Podcast, especially these classic editions, because there was a lot of fallout back in 2001 from WrestleMania 17. And so much was going on in that spring, Scott. And we just happened to have a great podcast episode that detailed a lot of it, don't we?
We absolutely did. I mean, if we tried to put everything in one podcast, JR, that WrestleMania X7 would have been about 7 hours.
Right.
So a couple days later after we recorded it on November 15th, 2013, episode 269, we did a summit. We sat around a big table and we talked about what happened in the spring of 2001 and what the future held. It was you, me, Scott Keith, one of our good old friends, Matt Petticord, and good old Will from Texas. Talked about the death of the two promotions, ECW, WCW, 17, Heyman replacing Jerry Lawler, maybe that greatest pay-per-view trilogy of all time from January to April, Vince, and just what the future held. So it was a fascinating summit to talk about what the rest of 2001 was going to bring.
Great episode, a lot of insights and a lot of fun to do. So kick back, enjoy this trip down memory lane, back to the spring of 01, back to November 2013. And we'll be back, Scott, Monday. Our buddy Pete Schermacher will be in the house to talk MSG from November 1985. So it should be a great listen. We'll talk to you Monday. Everyone, enjoy.
I see no changes. All I see is racist faces. Misplaced hate makes disgrace to races. We under. I wonder what it takes to make this one better place. Let's erase the wasted. Take the evil out the people, they'll be acting right. Cause both black and white and smoke a crack tonight. And the only time we chill is when we kill each other. It takes skill to be real time to heal each other. And although it seems heaven sent, we ain't ready to see a black president. It ain't a secret of the
black. Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be Podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming at you live this Thursday evening inside the PTB Man Cave, and we have an excellent action-packed episode lined up for you here tonight because it is time for another PTB Nation Summit. We'll be attacking a very interesting topic this time around. Of course, the last summit we had, we focused on tag team wrestling. It's time again for a new one. So, before we get going, let me bring in my PIC, my partner in crime, my co-host, Mr. Scott Criscolo. Scott, how you doing?
Good evening, JR. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Welcome, PTB Nation, to episode 269 of the Place to Be Podcast. And, I enjoyed our last summit at Reykjavik. We had a very nice talk about some of the greatest WWF/E tag teams of all time. Tonight, not that that topic was great, but that was a nice, basic, kind of easy to talk about topic. This one's got a little more meat to it. And we're gonna have a real nice. I mean, those guys were awesome in our first one. These guys, another action-packed, star-studded gentleman around the table tonight. So, why don't we dive in?
Well, before we get to that, why don't we hit up what's going on PlaceToBeNation.com?
Yes,
and then we'll bring in our guests. So we have a very interesting episode of Grapple Talk up right now, Scott. Because Callum Leslie was joined by Rashad Evans. Of course, he's got a big fight coming up with Chael Sonnen, and he chatted with Callum. So be sure to check that out at PlaceToBeNation.com, the exclusive interview with Rashad Evans by Callum Leslie, exclusive to Place to Be Nation. Hard-traveling fanboys, Greg and Nick were back, talking about their favorite writers. Always good there. Total Divas, watching Total Divas, back on the beat, Scott, Ben and Jen.
There we go.
Episode 1 kicked off of Season 2 this past Sunday.
Ugh.
And Ben and Jen do their best recapping that. And
they do a good job
there.
Yes, they do a good job.
Of course, Kings of Sport are back. They're talking about the issues with the Dolphins and Mr., of course, Richie Incognito, Scott's twin brother from another mother.
Sucker.
Josh Richards' Once Upon a Time reviews are up there as well. Adam Murray, Music Around the World Part 2. And this is an interesting one, Scott. I don't know if you got a chance to check this one out because one of the bands or one of the rappers he profiles is Action Bronson, who names all his songs after wrestlers.
Yes.
So it's interesting there. And he talks about all different other kind of music from around the world that you may not know of, but you may enjoy. So check that out, too. Maurice Pogue has a piece up on Valve and Diatribe. Caliber Winfield's Super Terrific Happy Hour, as always. New episode of the Brad and Chad Show talked about Atlanta sports.
Yes.
Talked about the potential sale of TNA. Issues going on with Chris Hero in the spring of 01, which is a topic very... on topic, I guess, for tonight.
Yes.
So if you want to check out Brad and Shannon, another episode of Titans of Wrestling. They deviated a little bit from where they were in the 80s WWF. Now talking about classic St. Louis wrestling in this episode.
Oh.
Yes, yeah, so Kelly took over the hosting duties, and he's got Parv and the crew there, and they talk about classic St. Louis from 1980s wrestling at the Chase. So good stuff there, of course. Mm-hmm. I get the usual recaps, Ring of Honor. Of course, as the week goes on here, we're going to have Impact, SmackDown. We had your Raw, interesting taped edition, of course, from London as we head towards Survivor Series next weekend. Andrew Riesch was a machine, as always, did a piece on college basketball's Big Bang, looking at the Champions Classic tip-off event that happened this week. Mm-hmm. If you're into college hoops, Andrew is pretty knowledgeable, so definitely check him out, all his
pretty
writing
good.
As the season goes on, yes. Richard the Mailman, we're back, Scott. The usual menagerie of topics, and a little treat, if you enjoy my stylings here, I will be joining Josh Richard, sitting in the mailman seat this weekend.
Oh, boy.
So the next episode will be up with me and Josh. We have some good stuff planned, and I think maybe a little cameo from Mr. Flanagan in there, too. We'll see.
Ah, very nice.
And, of course, a great piece, if you have not read it, my recommended piece of the past couple weeks right here. Andrew Riesch did a full look at Chris Hero, his shocking release, his career, and where he's headed next. And this thing got a lot of rub, a lot of play, and it is worth the read. It's a long one from Mr. Riesch, but really in-depth. This isn't just a news story you got everywhere else saying, oh, you know, Hero's released. This thing is in-depth. A lot going on here, and Riesch hit all the points, as he usually does, and does a great job, as always. So be sure to check out PlayStimulation.com. We have all your podcasts, all your comics, all your TV, your movies, your wrestling, your MMA, gaming, music, anything you want, we have for you. If you're interested in writing for us, you can email us at info@PlayStimulation.com. We're always taking applications and checking things out. We have some great new writers on the way. Not going to name them just yet, because I don't want to leave any out.
Mm-hmm.
But all kinds of cool stuff coming. Of course, we're going to have some Survivor Series-related content next week as well. And as we head into the big pay-per-view there next Sunday. And, of course, the live blog, as always, Scott, we'll have.
Yes.
Too. And also, if you have a question for me and Scott, you can email mailbag@PlayStimulation.com. Mm-hmm. We'll answer anything. It doesn't have to be just wrestling. It could be anything about life. We're gathering questions. We're going to come back, and we'll answer your mail. So any question for him, me, both of us, however you want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Scott, why don't we take a break? And when we come back, we will bring in our guests because it will be time to kick off our summit.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What I'd like to have right now.
Chad, do you ever feel that the world revolves around WWF?
I think you mean WWE there, Parv.
Yeah, whatever, but what about David Crockett?
He likes it!
Well, what about Jimmy Valiant?
I'm gonna get y'all until I get you, Paul Jones. Oh.
The Four Horsemen.
We are a family, and we are the best.
The Omni, the Dangerous Alliance.
Please welcome the newest members of the Dangerous Alliance, Arn Anderson and Larry Zbysko.
Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express.
The Fantastics are putting the U.S. Tag Team title on the line against the Midnight Express.
Main events with actual work rate in them.
Woo! 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 All right!
It's just not fair to Flair.
It's not fair for Flair.
If this is what you're looking for, please check out Where the Big Boys Play podcast, the only pure NWA and WCW supercard podcast out there.
While you were in Hollywood making movies, Thunderlips, I was winning world titles.
Well, there they are, our good friends Chad and Parr, Where the Big Boys Play. Now, if you want nonstop old-school NWA discussion, getting back to that very first Starrcade, these guys have it covered. Even the PICs have made an appearance once. We are very particular what podcasts we visit. So check out our friends Chad and Parr, Where the Big Boys Play. Their link is right on our site, PlayStimulation.com. Just go into the podcast menu. And there they are, the other great shows we partner with. Chad and Parr, working Where the Big Boys Play. Speaking of PlayStimulation, that's your everyday home for your pop culture needs. At PlayStimulation.com, we have everything. Wrestling, sports, comics, even polls. We want your opinions as well. Every day, there's something different with our top staff of writers who are experts in all fields of pop culture. From the weekly Raw review to the return of the hack, you've got everything you need. We're also working with a myriad of great podcasts, of course, besides Chad and Parv. We have Grapple Talk, the fan podcast, Off the Top Rope, Answering the 10 Count, We Found New Music, and the Kings of Sport with Nate Milton. We've got everything for your listening pleasure. So check us out every day of the week at PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Now, don't forget about our good friend Graham Cawthon and the history of WWE.com. He's still the top source for all argument solvers, from match results to house show cards to pay-per-view histories. Any questions you need answered? Any debates among wrestling fans that need ending? Head over to Graham's treasure trove of information. You will certainly find it. Need to know what the opener of Starrcade 1995 was? What was the main event of that 1988 Boston Garden house show you went to when you were 11 years old? Graham can tell you. He has WWE, WCW, ECW results, and the growing results in TNA and Ring of Honor. So for all your wrestling research needs, check out Graham Coffin at thehistoryofwwe.com. Now finally, if you want a place to just hang out, discuss all things wrestling with fellow diehard fans, check out the news and the great forums at twfnews.com. They have all the up-to-the-minute stories in WWE, TNA, and pretty much everywhere in between. They talk old school, Attitude Era, and even those hard-to-remember guys and shows like Waylon Mercy or In Your House Number 3. So check out all there is to see right on twfnews.com.
Tell you.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly, longtime announcer with the WWE, now the voice of Ring of Honor Wrestling. No better place to be than right here on the Place to Be podcast. Make sure you tune in every week.
Get ready to bow to the master. Yeah, boy.
Yo, you can try and hold me down if you want to. All the garbage I've been through, think I'm scared of you? I'll kill you. Don't got to care in the world of hell with the world. Man like me got...
All right, Nation, we are back from break, and it is time to get into our second PTBN Summit. We have a great roundtable here, and Scott, we're going to be talking about the winter-spring of 2001. Of course, we just did the WrestleMania 17 Vintage Vault last week, and we have a lot to talk about, so we're going to go through January till about April. No invasion yet this time around. We'll probably end right around where everything really closed up shop and leave things off there. So why don't we get right to it? We'll bring in our guests. First up, you read him weekly on PlaceToBeNation.com. He does a SmackDown report for us, and you see him over at Piledriver Wrestling as well, PDRWrestling.com. That is the one and only, the great Mr. Matt Petticord. Matt, welcome.
Hey, guys. Glad to be here.
Of course. I feel like we've known you forever, and this is the first time you're on, so we're looking forward to it.
Yeah. I was wondering when this was going to happen. I just, you know, just waiting for the opportunity.
Well, just like Dennis Stamp, you waited long enough and you got that call, so you're good to go.
I'm booked, man. I'm booked.
All right. Up next is a man, another guy we've known for a long time and just made his debut a few months back. Big fan of the show and, of course, the man behind RSPWFAQ.com, the one and only, the great Scott Keith. Scott, welcome back.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Great. Glad to have you back here and hopefully another fun episode with you. So, and making his debut as well here, he's the administrator over at ProWrestlingOnly.com, and you hear him weekly or biweekly as well at PlaceToBeNation.com, the man behind Goodwill Wrestling Podcast and all the other PWO family podcasts, the great Mr. Will H. Will, how you doing?
Hey, what's going on, man? Sorry I'm not Rob Naylor. That's all I have to say.
Hey, you know what? We take what we can get around here. So, as I mentioned, we're going to get right into things. We're going to talk spring of 01. It was a tumultuous time in the world of wrestling. We had major companies dropping like flies. WWF was on top of the world. Mainstream was really riding high. The XFL was in full force and looked like Vince and crew were untouchable. But we're going to start kind of at the bottom of the ladder, and that is with ECW. They went under in around February of 01. And we're going to start with you, Will. How much ECW were you watching in the final months? Were you ever an ECW fan, and what were your thoughts in those final days?
Well, I've told this story on a previous podcast that I've done with Gabe Sapolsky and Rob Naylor and other people when talking about ECW. Down in South Texas, man, we didn't have ECW until TNN. So I watched it when TNN got started. And I hadn't watched any of the tapes. I had known about some of the history, you know, through reading online, but I did not. I was not an ECW guy. And even after watching almost every year of ECW, I'm still not what you'd call an ECW guy. So ECW going down didn't really mean much to me.
All right. Now, Scott Keith, when you were on, we talked briefly about ECW, and it's pretty well known. You have your beef with the promotion. But what were your feelings towards the final days?
I was kind of indifferent towards it at that point. Like, my roommate at the time was the world's biggest ECW mutant, and I guess kind of the last person in the world still clinging on to the hope that they'd actually have a pay-per-view in 2001, like the Living Dangerously or whatever, the mythical one that was supposed to have happened in March of 2001.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, we we kind of followed it all the way down the drain to its demise and got the weekly tapes and everything like that. But I was never what you call a fan of the product or anything like that. I was a fan of the money I made from trading the tapes of the product to other people who wanted it. But, in fact, I think I probably made more money off the promotion than Paul Heyman did.
That's probably true.
I know a thing or two about bootlegging. So, anyway.
All right. How about you, Matt?
Well, I live in North Carolina, and so as far as I know, unless there was something I didn't know about, we didn't get ECW down here either until it was on TNN. And even when it was on TNN, I was so engrossed in WCW and WWF that I never really gave them a chance once they came on TNN. So never really was a fan. I watched probably most of the shows from 94 and 95, but I mean, it's an okay product. It's just nothing that I would say, man, I'm just such a huge fan of.
So, Scott Criscolo, I guess I'll just call you PIC for the day, so we can keep you and Keith straight. But
yes.
So it sounds like you were in on ECW early out of all of us here. So what are your thoughts on the dying days? Because you were watching as early as like 94, right?
Yeah, I mean, we had it on MSG, Madison Square Garden Network. As early as, pretty much late 94 and early 95. And I was bummed because it was a fun option to have. Particularly, I mean, I was graduating college when I started watching it. And, you know, as we all know, WWF was pretty, I don't want to say putrid, but it wasn't great. And WCW wasn't bad. But, you know, this was I got to say, you know what, when me and my buddies first started watching it, ECW was the fun wrestling to watch when you were drunk. You know, because then you kind of enjoyed it more when like JT Smith would fall off and then the whole dorm would chant "you fucked up" all the way up and down the hallway. So, I mean, it was a lot of fun, and I was bummed. Now, the last few months of 01 were not anything before that, obviously. But, I enjoyed it. I liked the alternative, and I have to say I'm the opposite. I didn't like it much when it went to TNN. I thought it was a little tamer. I liked it more in the 95 through 98 days. I thought it was a little rougher, and I thought that was what made it better than it was once it got to TNN. But it was sad. It was sad to see it go. It was a nice option to have in the mid 90s, but wasn't surprising. I mean, it wasn't a secret that Paul was lousy with money. We were reading stuff about guys not getting checks and that kind of thing, so it was inevitable. Sadly,
let me ask you this, Keith, because this is something we talked about on our WrestleMania 17 podcast. Did you think Heyman should have sold high when, and maybe not completely got out of ECW, but maybe brought in an investor and tried to transition some of that when they were on TNN and when the business model was kind of up? I mean, do you think being someone that's pretty adept at business as he is, could have seen the writing on the wall and know that things are probably at their peak and he should try and get someone in there?
I think it was more complicated than that, just because Vince McMahon was so heavily into investing in the product at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not, like, you know, obviously I'm not a business guy or anything like that, but I mean, I think it's come out that Vince was pretty heavily invested into it from quite a long ways back, and it might have been a situation where he just wasn't able to divest himself of the product, basically.
All right, Will, so were you aware, or do you have any knowledge, was Vince still supporting ECW right to the end? Because I know he was doing it back in, like, 97, 98.
He had to have been. The takeover was too easy. I don't know if he was supporting him up until the day Paul Heyman kind of ran out on his wrestlers and wouldn't answer his phones. But, I mean, I'm sure Heyman knew. I'm sure Vince either told Heyman, hey, I'm not writing checks anymore, or, hey, give me your company and I'll bail you out, or of whatever situation you're in and you can be a talent. Something had to have happened to where Heyman had a cush job for, what, a year and a half, or however mm-hmm. long he was actually talent, you know, on air until Lawler came back. Something had to have happened for Vince to just slide in. I don't know. My good buddy Johnny P just did a documentary on ECW called Barbed Wire City.
Right.
And I don't know if he ever got that answer, because, you know, Heyman refused to talk to him. Tommy Dreamer didn't want to talk to him because he's kind of a Heyman guy. You know, Tommy Dreamer would talk to him off the record, but never on the record or on film. So I think there's just a lot of speculation. I don't even think a guy like Meltzer would know.
Yeah, that seems to be one of the most mysterious questions out there, is why Vince did it and for how long he did. Because it seems we can never get a straight answer. But I get why maybe he did it early on. And I can probably see why he cut the cord at the end, because they were so popular, they didn't really need this to support them, because I don't know if the benefit was there anymore. I think they already kind of bled the well dry of ECW talent they kept bringing in.
Right, and Jim Ross is supposed to be writing a book soon, so maybe Jim Ross was in the know. Maybe we'll get it from Jim Ross's book. Who knows?
I think there's a lot that may come from that book. A lot of questions we've been all waiting to have answered. He may finally, because I feel like him and Vince are the guys that hold the keys to a lot of those secrets that we've all wondered kind of over the last few years. So, Keith, why do you think everyone was so loyal to Paul at the end? The guys that were working basically on a prayer and a hope that they were going to get paid.
I know Tommy Dreamer was. I think a lot of it came down to Paul pushing the guys that nobody else was going to push at that point. Like, especially at the end, you had the guys like Justin Credible, who was not going to get any kind of serious look anywhere else, and Paul was making him world champion. So that, or Jerry Lynn, you know, who's a smaller guy who never got a serious look in either the other two promotions, either like that. So, I mean, even if money was not necessarily the issue, a lot of it, I think, came down to just the way that Paul treated them better than anybody else would, and kind of got him to drink his Kool-Aid.
Matt,
hey, can I jump in there real quick?
Yeah, go ahead, Will. Yep.
Because this one, I actually do have a couple of stories, a little inside info. I actually got into an argument with Gabe Sapolsky when we interviewed him, because him and Rob Naylor, they defended Justin Credible as a champion. They're like, you know, he's a workhorse, and he did everything we asked him, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, dude, the guy was there doing DX symbols in Stone Cold shorts with the Undertaker's finishing move. It wasn't meant to be. I mean, the guy was not, you know, somebody who could draw. I mean, you draw on all these other popular wrestlers and just kind of take apart from each one of them, you know, kind of had like the Goldberg goatee thing going too, right? And it was just, I agree. But like the guys like Tajiri, who did make it in WWE and had like a nice little run, you know, those are, I think the guys who actually made it and kind of thrived afterwards were the ones that were going to make it. And, you know, I talked to my buddy Johnny P about this too, and everybody was actually kind of optimistic because they thought Paul was actually going to get them all a job in WWE. Like he was going to take the whole roster and get them a job, you know, and that didn't happen. So there's a lot of bitter feelings there too. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. Just want to throw that in there.
Yeah. So, and kind of playing right off that question, Matt, which wrestlers do you think that the ones that were hanging around at the end of ECW had the most potential going forward? I mean, the obvious one, Rob Van Dam, but outside of him, who did you think had potential to make it in WWF, or even, you know, WCW wasn't dead and buried when ECW was first fading in February. So in either company, which guys did you think kind of had that potential to make it?
Well, in ECW, I would say probably most of the guys are, I mean, I know this is 2001, but even then there was a publicly traded company. There's a lot of those guys I would say that WWE never would have given a second look to, or like it would just been kind of irresponsible. Guys like Sabu or Sandman. New Jack. Guys like that, I just can't see them giving them a serious look and saying, yeah, those are the guys that we're going to push. You wanted me to give an opinion on WCW too?
No, just ECW for now. I just meant guys that you thought maybe would have made it in either promotion if WCW had lived on as well.
Oh, well,
if I could jump in too. Mikey Whipwreck was another one who was tragically misused by WCW. Like him, his crazy persona in ECW at the end with James Mitchell, that was money. That could have been something too.
Yeah.
And I think Mitchell's even a guy that was kind of whiffed on. That
I agree with
been
that, definitely.
More. Yeah, Scott, you've always been a big Mitchell fan.
I like Mitchell a lot. I liked him a lot. I loved him in TNA when he got there. But I thought Mitchell would have been a good guy for WCW again after they let him go. And then he just, you know, I don't know. It was a guy I liked that I thought could have been used better and never was and wasn't. So,
Will, do you think there's any? Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, go. No, ask a question.
I was just going to ask you, is there any guy you thought that was in ECW outside of, you know, RVD's the easy answer, but that could have maybe salvaged WCW? Not just survive there, but anyone they could have brought in to kind of help bump the company back.
And that could have actually thrived? No. They didn't. I don't think so. I think Tajiri was probably the most talented, and we saw how far he made in WWF, you know, entertaining character, great facial expressions, right? If he was put in a match, I mean, where they allowed him to showcase his strengths, had some good, really good matches. So I think, you know, to me, Tajiri's the most charismatic. Steve Corino, if it was 1987, would have been awesome.
Right.
I love Corino, man. The guy's a sweetheart. He's an awesome guy personally. But I love the way he wrestles. You know, I'm a throwback, man. I like old Southern bloody wrestling. And to see somebody try to embrace that and, you know, have bull rope matches with Dusty Rhodes, man, I'm all over that. I'm like, sign me up. You know, and I think, where did he go? He went to MLW after ECW was dead and gone. So, I mean, you know, who else was there? Scotty Riggs? I mean, good-looking guy, I guess, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's anybody that could have saved the mess that WCW was in at the end.
Yeah, the WCW was long dead. I mean, books have been written, rants have been spoken, right, Scott? I mean, you know,
yeah,
WCW was a fucking mess. You know, and are we talking about WCW? Because I got a lot to say about
them. Oh, yeah, wait, they're coming.
Okay, yeah, we'll stay on ECW, but no, man, I mean, ECW was dead. I mean, you watch those pay-per-views, those last few pay-per-views, you had those really hot tag matches with, who was it, Tajiri and Whipwreck were the tag team, right, that were putting on the hot matches?
Yeah, Super Crazy was in there, too. He was having some good
matches. Okay, yeah, Super Crazy was real hot that last year. Little Guido was awesome. You know, I love the way he kind of incorporated, like, the comedy with the shoot style, with the, I mean, he could brawl and fly with the best of them too. So I really liked Lil Guido, but these are utility players, right? That would have never had a shot at the main event in WWE because of their size. And WCW, I mean, they weren't going to get any traction. They would have probably been like, who was the guy? Was it Kid Cash or Jason Jett? Like, is that his name? Jason Jett? I'm trying to think. Like, I mean, all those guys would have been thrown in with, like, the Cruisers with Chavo and Helms and Ray at the end, you know, or, you know, squashed on TV by Scott Steiner or Sid or something, you know.
Right.
I mean, they weren't going to do anything with them. You know, we saw what WCW would do with, like, a character like Sandman. I'm saying Sandman's a great wrestler, but he was a great character in WCW, completely neutered. Mikey Whipwreck was brought up earlier in WCW. Just the face in the crowd. Nobody gave a shit because the company didn't give us a reason to give a shit. And so that's what would have happened to RVD, Sabu. You know, we saw it with Shane Douglas, right? He was like the fourth best guy in Revolution, or what was the name of it?
Yeah, Revolution.
Yeah, Revolution. So, I mean, you know, these Too Cold Scorpio was an awesome talent. I mean, I know he was long gone from ECW. But look what WWF did with him, Flash Funk. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the best talents that the ECW had to offer, when they were picked up by the Big Two, that the Big Two did nothing with them, or, you know, they kind of exposed the flaws of having those guys on your roster in the first place. So, you know, fuck them.
So, Keith, so basically with all the answers we all gave here, it's proof that ECW is pretty much devoid of big-name talent at that point. And you know, with Paul Heyman's strengths, he could still hide some of that. But who do you think was the biggest blow over the last couple of years to ECW that left, that really kind of did some, you know, irreparable damage?
I think Raven leaving was a huge one, I think, when he affected WCW with Stevie Richards. Because that was basically the core of their kind of upper mid-card just completely ripped out and they didn't get anything out of it. The Tommy Dreamer feud never paid off. And not to mention Raven's kind of a brilliant booking mind who Paul could bounce things off of for the most part. And there was just something, he just left and the company never really came back to the levels it was reaching at that point, I think.
Matt, who do you think was the biggest loss?
I would agree with Raven, but I guess you never know what Mike Awesome was going to do. That's another guy I know that defected. But like you say, he's one of those guys you don't ever know what he could have done in ECW. He was just another guy in WCW, but he could have been something for them, I'm sure.
Yeah. How about you, Scott?
I like the Raven choice too. I would like to say the Dudleys, but I don't even know if they would have helped in 2000. As crazy as it may sound, I wish they had had Bigelow for a little longer. I think he would have been a good, solid, top-level a guy throughout the end if he was able to stick around. I would say the Dudleys, even more than Taz. Because I think the Dudleys were really hot in 99. And even when they left at the end of 99, when Raven came back and they got the titles off them, I thought that was a tough blow, even more than Taz. I think Taz had reached his ceiling, no pun intended. I think the Dudleys were the toughest loss. Because 2000, other than RVD, remember RVD was hurt, I think, throughout most of 2000.
Right. Yeah.
A lot of the star quality by the beginning of 2000 was pretty much gone from ECW. It was a husk.
Let me ask this, though, because what did you think the Dudleys could do? I mean, did you see anything in them in singles guys? Or, I mean, were they draws at that point? What do you think? I feel like Taz was the bigger loss, personally.
Were you asking me?
Well, open up to everybody else. Open.
Yeah, go ahead, Will.
Okay, no, I was just going to say that I agree that the Dudleys were hot, man. They got that crowd so pissed off, you know. But I think they were also a detriment because then you got stuck with the Dudleys lighting tables on fire, you know, taking it to the extreme or whatever, you know, jumping off. I think that they started to join New Jack, at least Spike Dudley did, you know, with jumping off balconies and one or two of the Dudleys had to have jumped off a balcony at one time, right, Devon or Bubba?
To me,
that was a detriment because at that point, once you're jumping off balconies and you're going through flaming tables, it's not good enough for Mike Awesome just to throw Spike Dudley out of the ring, past the third row, and into a table. Now you have to put fire on the table. You know, at that point, you know, where else is there to go? There's nowhere else to go. And then, you know, WWE even had to, like, quote-unquote, retrain their audience later to kind of accept less garbage. You know, obviously no blood, you know, and whatever. So I don't know. I don't think that any one person hurt them. I think it was the because ECW's always done more with less, right? Isn't that kind of Paul Heyman's calling card?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to highlight your strengths, hide your weaknesses, make you a character that somebody would normally not care about. You know, that's why all these guys are like the island of misfit toys, because they go there and they thrive, right? But you put them in a corporate setting, in a setting where you're seen nationally, and they shrink. They all shrink. The Dudleys thrived.
But, yeah, I was gonna say the Dudleys are definitely the exception to that one because they were to the point in ECW where it was, you know, very big fish in a very small pond and they had to go somewhere else.
Yeah, RVD thrived, but I mean y'all said Raven, but then like when Raven went to WCW, it really highlights that here he was never got past the mid card, right? I mean, I think he won the TV title, never won the US title, right? Or did he?
He had it for the one night, right?
For one night, yeah, got squashed by Goldberg.
Oh, yeah, because Goldberg beat him for it, right?
Yeah.
And that was like one of the best Goldberg matches in history.
Yeah,
Okay, so he had it for a one whopping night, you know, but never got past that level in WCW, which kind of highlights, you know, once again, but he was better. It would have been better if he would have stayed in ECW, maybe for ECW's sake, but for Raven's sake, except for those big paychecks. But, I think Dudleys and RVD are the only ones who kind of came out like bigger stars, right? Or I guess Tajiri, I don't know, man. The whole thing frustrates me, that company, the way it was run and whatever. So I don't think that any one person leaving like really like was the straw that broke ECW's camel's back. I think it was, you know, dropping a fucking anvil on the camel and, you know, letting it explode that could happen with all of the raids. I think that's the best way I could interpret that, you know, is that it was too many too soon, all in like a short period of time, and then you were left with the dregs or the midgets or the foreigners, you know.
So, Keith, do you think knowing Heyman's strengths and, you know, I don't want to say the intelligence because it was an interesting mix, but the overall relative intelligence of their crowds and their close followers, do you think if he had the money, if he had the support and was able to stay in business, do you feel like he would have been ahead of the curve as far as reinventing ECW? Because I thought Will made a good point saying, you know, how much further could you go with the flaming tables, the balconies and everything else? Did you already see a turn in 01 and maybe where Heyman saw things heading? Do you think he would have went to more of a map-based style that he would push later when he went to WWF?
Oh, yeah. You could definitely see he had toned it down for the network. Like, that was one of his major complaints about it. But, I mean, like, it was the product was definitely swinging towards, like, the three-ways that we were mentioning there, like with your Super Crazies and Tajiris and the Mikey Tajiri team was just great at the end of those matches with the FBI.
Yeah. Right.
And it was becoming like that kind of thing that was almost the centerpiece of the promotion and everything else was just kind of the sideshow. And I think he really was. He was trying to retool the promotion around who he had left and doing what he always does, which was disguising the weaknesses and putting forth the strengths.
All right, so ECW goes down in February, just kind of quietly goes away. Pay-per-view doesn't happen. TV disappears. And that's it. Things fold up, and all of a sudden, we tune into Raw. Jerry Lawler's gone. Paul Heyman's in the booth. Matt, what were your thoughts that night when you turned on to Raw and saw Paul Heyman in the commentary booth next to JR?
It was certainly strange. I mean, Jerry Lawler had been on Raw, since 94, 95?
Yeah.
It was very strange, to say the least. I mean, especially since I didn't really follow ECW. I didn't know what happened to it and why Heyman was all of a sudden on Raw.
So, Will, instant upgrade in the booth, though, right? Not even a debate.
Yeah, I'm actually going to preface this by saying that Jerry Lawler is my favorite wrestler of all time.
Right.
So, for me to say, you know, Jerry Lawler, the announcer, go away, you know, enough puppies, enough.
Especially at that point.
Yeah, man, it was just overkill. I mean, and Jerry Lawler has, you know, called some great matches, too. I mean, when he wants to be mm-hmm. Jerry Lawler, he can call a great match. But, yeah, it was time for him to go. I thought Jerry Lawler needed to go, you know, just for the show. Not even for Jerry Lawler or for Paul Heyman's sake, just for the show, man.
Yeah.
It was such an improvement, you know. And I actually kind of like Lawler now. Now that, you know, it's not TNA and puppies every week, I actually kind of like Lawler sometimes, because you can tell that the guy doesn't prepare, you know, he doesn't watch the SmackDown shows, so he doesn't know what's going on there, he just says whatever's on his mind. He probably if Vince is yelling and something in his ear, he's probably not saying it if he doesn't want to, you know. I kind of like Jerry Lawler for that weird effect, not because, you know, he's on the Lance Russell level or anything, but just you know, because you can kind of tell, hey, man, I survived a heart attack on live TV. I don't give a shit. You know?
He's old and he's backing out.
That's
all he is.
What was that, brother?
I said he's old and he's backing out, like the old Jerry Seinfeld joke. He said, no matter how old he is, he's so old at this point, he doesn't give a shit. He's backing out. If you're in the way, you're in the way.
Yeah, man. I mean, he's collecting a paycheck, man. But at the time, man, I mean, it was a stale act, man. And I say that, you know, and he was having great matches into the 60s, man. They should have had them in there brawling with Stone Cold or something. He could still go, man. It wasn't like Lawler was like rapidly deteriorating or anything. I mean, he could still go and he could still get crowds into his matches and get people to care about him. We saw that with his match with The Miz a few years back. So, mm-hmm. You know, people genuinely cared about Lawler. You know, the Cole feud was an atrocity, but Lawler should have been in the ring, man. But, you know, his love for young girls kind of did him in there. So.
Keith, do you think WrestleMania 17 is great? You know, pretty much the best WrestleMania, perfect pay-per-view from them. Do you think it would have taken a hit with King in the booth instead of Heyman?
I don't think announcing was that big of a deal to it. I honestly don't even remember Paul Heyman as an announcer at this point. Like, it's for me, it's all a blur of Jerry Lawler from the last, you know, 13 or so years. So, no, I think I don't pay that much attention to announcing where it would have been either, you know, a detriment to the product or anything like that. I mean, they both have their charms and their weaknesses and things like that.
I think the upgrade to Heyman at that time was so stark because of as much as Lawler had just descended into this goofy pit of, he just got really comfortable. Him and JR got really comfortable and the TNA stuff and the puppy stuff. And Heyman was like a throwback to the Ventura days of, everything was very serious. Everything he put over the backstory. He knew the backstories. It was, to me, it amazed me how quickly he came in and immediately knew everything about everyone that was going on. I mean, he either did some crazy preparation or he had been following along anyway, kind of knowing what was coming. Because he was on point immediately and knew all the backstories, knew all the wrestlers, all the storylines. I thought it was just a really impressive job he did right on the first night. So the first 3 months of 2001, those three pay-per-views, widely considered probably three of the best in company history. And I think this is an interesting debate. We'll start with you, Matt. Can you think of any three other pay-per-views in their company history or in WCW history that can top Royal Rumble, No Way Out, and WrestleMania 17 in 2001? In consecutive pay-per-views, obviously.
Yeah, consecutively. That's very tough to do, three in a row. I mean, two is very simple, but three, I can't think of too many.
What do you think, Keith? You have any?
2000 would be knocking on the door with a few of them, but then probably have shit like King of the Ring or WrestleMania 16 inserted in there that break it up.
Right.
I'm a huge fan of all three of those pay-per-views at the beginning of 2001 for sure.
I think three that maybe contend, and Scott and Will, I want your thoughts on this. The 94 WCW stretch that had Spring Stampede, Slamboree, and Bash at the Beach. Will, what do you think of those three there? Do those come close?
Hell yeah. Spring Stampede and Slamboree had some awesome matches, man.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what else. What was on Bash at the Beach that year?
I can look it up quick. It was Hogan Flair, which I think is a pretty underrated match for them. I thought that was solid for them.
Then you also got Pretty Wonderful against Cactus Jack and Kevin Sullivan, which is the longest match in history. I think it's still going on right now, actually.
Yes. I feel like...
Here we go.
Yeah, didn't Austin have a pretty good match? Scott, you have it there?
Yeah, I got it here. Dark match was Brian... It was July 17th from Orlando. The dark match was Brian Armstrong and Brad Armstrong against Steve Kern and Bobby Eaton. Lord Steven Regal beat Johnny B. Badd to retain the TV title. Badd actually was replacing Sting in that match. Vader beat the Guardian Angel by DQ. Funk and Buckhouse Buck defeated Dustin Rhodes and Arn. Steve defeated Ricky to retain the U.S. title. It was a 20-minute match.
Yeah.
Coming up on their eighth fall, Pretty Wonderful against Cactus and Kevin Sullivan. That match was 5 seconds longer than the Austin match. And then the main event was Hogan and Flair.
And that was just a minute longer than Pretty Wonderful. So, yeah,
yes.
Pretty good memory on that one, Keith. That was...
Who in their right mind gives Paul Roma and Cactus Jack 20 minutes to do a tag team match? Like,
yeah, that's a long stretch.
I don't know, man.
No,
I was going to say, I think that show maybe puts a chink in that armor. But go ahead, Bill.
Well, I would only say this, that if you were to ask me to go back and revisit those three 1994 pay-per-views, or the three 2001 pay-per-views, I think I would, just because of the style of wrestling that I like, I'd rather go revisit the WCW pay-per-views.
Interesting.
I'm trying to think. I don't think ECW had three pay-per-views in a row that I would have liked that much.
How about 92?
Hold on. 2011, Money in the Bank was followed by SummerSlam.
Right.
And I really liked those pay-per-views. What came before Money in the Bank that year?
Yes.
Over the Edge. Or
Capital Punishment. Yeah, Cena and R-Truth.
Yeah. Okay. So that does not fit. So.
No.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know, man. I wouldn't argue against it, but man, I'm gonna go back and watch some 1994 WCW guys.
Well,
you all talk.
You know, if you're going with the 94 WCW ones too, you can go backwards. Super Bowl four was a pretty pretty decent show.
Here's Super Bowl four. Here's the card just to let everyone in. Here's the card for Super Bowl four, which was February. It was Harlem Heat against Thunder and Lightning, Jim Steele against Equalizer, Terry Taylor against DDP. Johnny B. Badd against Jimmy Garvin, Lord Steven Regal against Arn for the TV title. That was almost 28 minutes.
Jesus.
Cactus Jack, Max Payne against the Nasty Boys. Sting, Pillman, and Dustin against Austin, Rude, and Orndorff in a Thunder Cage. And
that was
Flair,
a hell of a match.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then Flair and Vader in a Thunder Cage for the world title. That was Super Bowl IV. Spring Stampede. Was
all right, I think we know Spring Stampede and Slam.
Yeah,
I think everyone knows those. There's a stretch of 92 WCW as well. Wrestle War, which of course had the awesome Dangerous Alliance blow off in the War Games. Beach Blast 92 had Steamboat and Rude and the Iron Man, and Steiners versus Gordy and Williams 30-minute draw, and then Great American Bash 92, which I believe is a pretty good show as well. That had Vader and Sting, so that might be even better than the 94 stretch.
You could also use Super Brawl 2 in that too.
Yes, another great show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good.
Yeah, Super Brawl 2, Wrestle War 92,
Beach Blast.
And Beach Blast. That, I think that's the winner right there, because Great American Bash had some good matches on it, but it was like 6 hours long, man. Well, with all those tag matches.
It was all tag matches. Right?
Yeah.
And so, they had the awesome Vader Sting match. And yeah, I would say that those other three, though, man, that might be the three best pay-per-views in a row, man.
So you might argue this is the best four pay-per-view stretch, if you want to say the best. I mean, if you can't think of another four anywhere.
I don't think I would include Great American Bash, though.
Yeah?
No, nah, just too much tag wrestling. Yeah.
It was a long show.
It's kind of boring, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a good debate. I think even WWF 92, you can maybe, Rumble, Mania, and SummerSlam 92 were in the discussion, too.
Yeah.
Mania 92, that was Bret Hart and Piper?
Yep, and Savage and Flair.
Okay, but those basically, were there any, like, really hot tags, like rocker matches or something? Because that's kind of a two-match, three-match show, isn't it?
Yeah, those two matches are really, really good. But yeah, that's really pretty much it on that show. Unless you're a big natural disaster.
It's like a two or three match show too, right?
Yeah, that was Warrior, Savage, and Brett Bulldog. They were top heavy shows, but the matches that were on top, I thought were just really, really good. So.
Yeah. Like I said, no, I think that WCW, man, 92 stretch, man. I think that might, at least for my taste, man, I'd rather go watch that or those 94 pay-per-views.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really excited about kind of going to see Bash at the Beach now. Y'all talking me into it.
Well, so. you should go watch all these nine pay-per-views and report back to us, please.
Okay.
There you go. I like it. Easy.
I'm doing it.
All right, Keith. Keith, where do you compare this era of WWF to their other hot periods? Where does it rank? I mean, if we look at the Rock and Wrestling, and I guess the Attitude, I mean, those are the two biggest. Where do you think this period of early 01 ranks?
Well, I mean, if it wasn't for the XFL, it would be probably the most profitable period ever. Unfortunately, they pumped a lot of money into that and didn't go very well for them. I think perhaps Kurt Angle locking The Rock in the ankle lock and telling them that he's going to break his fucking ankle if he doesn't tap might be one of the greatest things ever as well.
Pretty awesome.
So it's got that going for it, too. I was certainly very into the product at that point as compared to some other times in their history. But I don't know, 2000's really hard to top. I mean, that was like a whole year of awesome stuff. Like, just going through back and listening to you guys do the reviews on the pay-per-views on the podcast is made me realize how great some of that stuff was from that period there, too.
Mm. And so many forgotten matches this in the mix. I mean, and we didn't even get into the TV, which was really good as well in 2000. We kind of touched on some of it. But what do you think, Matt, as far as looking at that time period versus the other profitable times in company history?
Well, I think it kind of snowballed, or however you want to say it. It was kind of hot just because of the year 2000, or even 99, as far back as 99. The storylines I didn't really care for that much, but the matches were certainly really good, and I think they were just kind of coasting after the hot year that they had in 2000, really, especially with storylines. And this is right after when Stephanie took over, so it really, to me, it really wasn't anywhere near as good as it was in 2000.
So, Will, do you agree or disagree with that? And do you think it was just a matter of, was the pay-per-view just so good because they had such good talent, but do you think that the quality of programming was down?
Well, I have mixed feelings, because 2001, a lot of things happened. I got married in 2001. not that y'all care or anything, I'm just saying. But, like, for me, when I was watching it, I would, you know, make sure that when the pay-per-views were going on, I was there every week. But by the end of the year, I think 2000, you know, by the end of the year, I was kind of tuned out, man. The Invasion really soured me on the product, the way they handled it. I'm a huge Steve Austin fan, so Austin kind of kept me engaged. I love the Rock Jericho series. I thought that was awesome. And that we're talking 2001 here, right?
Yeah, like first half. First quarter.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was getting ahead of
him. Nah, it's all right. It's all right.
You know, but the first quarter, I mean, nah, man, I was glued, man. I mean, I was there, man. Every pay-per-view, I was into the product. But it was kind of a weird time, because it's also when I really got deep into the internet culture.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of had an out because I would read websites like DVDVR, TOA with John V. Williams, WrestleLine where Scott Keith was writing, and I was discovering all this other new footage, you know, and reading all these histories of wrestlers and stuff. So I was discovering Japanese wrestling and lucha and Puerto Rican bloodbaths and Memphis that I never knew Jerry Lawler was a legend somewhere, you know, had no idea, you know. So I was kind of discovering and learning all of this stuff at that time. So to me, it was kind of the peak of me just being a fan, period. Not just in WWF, mm-hmm. but just in wrestling, just being so excited that there's all of this wrestling out there to be discovered on top of a hot TV product that you still watch Monday nights. But then with a slight taste of bitterness in your mouth, because the company that got you back into wrestling, WCW, ended, you know, with a whimper. You know what I mean? And being so bitter that I kind of cheered for WCW during that time. And I had no idea until, you know, later, you know, when I started, like, you know, getting the Meltzer books and the Alvarez's book and subscribing to The Observer. I had no idea how incompetent they were. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like behind the scenes. And it was kind of like for y'all that have been, like, I know Scott Keith, you've been on the internet for 20 years now, right? I mean, you kind
yeah,
of like
for making
were
feel old.
Wrestling. Well, no, I'm just as old as you are.
Oh, that's good. Okay. You
know? But the thing is, though, is that, you know, part of being part of the wrestling community online, you were there in the night. I mean, hell, man, my David Bixenspan, I don't even know if he's 30 yet. He's been on for 20 years. You know, he was like a preteen posting on these boards, you know. I mean, so I'm not trying to make you feel old. I'm just trying to say you were there at the beginning.
Right.
You know, where yeah, I wasn't, man. I discovered all this shit later, you know.
Yeah, we definitely knew that WCW was a bunch of fuck-ups even back then, that's for sure.
Yeah, whereas all I saw was, ooh, who are they bringing in next week? Oh, my God, did you see Goldberg, man? He's going to kill him, you know. I mean, there was something kind of refreshing and exciting about that period. And then by the end of 98 with WCW, you just, like, fuck this company, you know. And then, but back to 2001, I was just so excited that I could go back and find, you know, tape dealers to pick up all of this stuff from around the world and from the past. And I'm still excited to find new wrestling from the past. So, you know, that time really carried me. So I have nothing but positive memories from that first half of 2001 for WWF because of where I was at as a fan. That's kind of why I did that long little speech there. I kind of want you to understand that I wasn't evaluating it through being like a smart mark or you know, being in the know. I was just, as someone discovering all this new stuff on top of this hot product on TV, it was just really exciting for me to be there, you know, and to you know, watch that and then see my first Kawada match, like, you know, around the same time, you know, just first Mid-South match around the same time, because I used to watch the UWF when I was a kid, but Mid-South wasn't national. It was the UWF, I think, when I first saw it, so... It's a really exciting time for me, man. Love it.
And Keith, I think the internet thing's interesting because, yes, obviously you were very deeply in the internet community at that point. What was your feeling on Vince and the WWF? Because I think this is very prevalent, that they could do no wrong, that they anything they touched was going to turn to gold. They were on such a hot streak. The underground groundswell that had been with them since, like, 98 when they were kind of the underdog was still there. When do you feel that kind of started to dissipate a little bit? And am I right in remembering that Vince was really pretty much the gold standard at that time?
Yeah, well, you know when it changed for me? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were...
Yeah, let's get Keith, and then we'll come to Will. Go ahead.
My point, I was like, here in, and it's kind of weird, too, because up here in Canada, WCW wasn't really like a thing. Nitro was not aired on TV until well into its run. So WCW never really gained any traction at all. Although sentiments swung heavily against Vince, obviously, in 1997 after Montreal to a certain degree. But, yeah, it's like Canada as a whole has always been basically WWF country completely. So that's always the perspective that I was coming on with. And, yeah, certainly, that's like 2000 and the whole Attitude Era, it was such a hot period overall for them that it was hard for them to really do any wrong in the fans' eyes. And I think really it wasn't until 2002 with the whole Triple H thing that sentiment really, really swung against them heavily, I think.
Yeah, I feel like they had a lot of lingering positivity where people kind of explain away a lot of what was wrong, you know? So it was like, oh.
The benefit of the doubt going on.
Definitely. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think that was residual for a while, Matt. Do you agree?
Say it again?
Do you agree that it was they had such residual goodwill that even the stuff, no pun intended, even the stuff that they did wrong in late 2000, early 2001 was easily explained away by a lot of the fans because they were on such a hot streak, they were doing so much right that it was easy to overlook some of the mistakes that maybe, in hindsight, were glaring, that saying, okay, wow, we didn't notice where they were headed with some of this stuff.
Yeah, when you're hot, I mean, you can't really do any wrong, it seems, in wrestling promotions. So, yeah, I would agree with that.
Will, what's your take on it?
Actually, there are a couple of things, man, that stand out to me that bothered me in 2000. One was the Jericho Phantom title switch. When I think of that, at the time, this is me trying to think back at the time that bothered me, it was that there was no follow-up. Like, Jericho Triple H wasn't on the next pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just like, threatens Earl Hebner. It was more about Triple H and the referees than it was about Jericho and Triple H, or Jericho, like, having the shot. You know what I mean?
Right.
That crowd was fucking hot for Jericho, man. You know, Jericho, and then Jericho's, like, quickly, like, right there back in the IC title picture. Never sniffs the world title until, the Rock program, you know. And then that bothered me. And no resolution to the Kurt Angle Stephanie storyline, you know, the weak resolution. Or
right.
Did Triple H just end up going over on Kurt Angle with that one too? I don't remember.
Yeah, that was the first one when they really, really dropped the ball, I think. Like they were doing
that. And so, like, so those were the ones that bothered me, like, watching as a fan. But then online, reading that they were confiscating fan signs.
Hmm.
That at that point in time, I'm like, wait a minute. You know, they had positioned themselves for the last 3-4 years or whatever as this company that listens to their fans. And you thought it was true, right? Because when the Radicals come in, they actually push the Radicals. They give them meaningful programs. They give them characters. And you know, that early time of the Radicals, I mean, they kind of did pretty well with them. When Jericho came in, he got the star treatment. When Taz comes in, he gets star treatment. They build up Kurt Angle as this new star. So you think that they're doing the right things, you know, and trying to get, like, a new generation of guys over. But then when I hear that, wait, they're upset that the fans are booing Rocky and cheering Austin, so they're confiscating signs that are negative towards Rocky. You know what I mean? Like, wait a minute. I thought you listened to your fans. If the mm-hmm. fans want to boo Rocky, let them boo Rocky. You know, and then the Austin heel turn, which you talked about on your last show, right?
Yes.
I mean, I live in Texas, man. You don't fucking turn Steve Austin in Texas. It's stupid. You know, I mean, and I know Austin wanted to be heel. It wasn't the time or place. Let him turn heel on a B show up in, Austin was hot everywhere, right? But let him turn B, up somewhere up north so he can talk about how much the Yankees sucked or something. I don't know. You know, you don't do it in Texas and Houston. I mean, in his backyard, you know. I don't know what they were thinking there. So, I mean, you know, but hearing that the fans were confiscating signs was when I thought, okay, they don't really listen to their fans. You know, that's when it really bothered me the most.
Scott, Keith, what do you think about, you know, kind of, I don't know if you heard the WrestleMania 17 pod yet, but we talk about turning Austin the next night on Raw, having Vince's interference maybe be a little bit screwy but not obvious, and Austin wins the title, you keep him face, like Will said, you don't want to turn him there. Then the next night you do the exact same thing and you turn him heel there. Do you think that could have helped work, or are you fine with the way it went?
Yeah, it was definitely the wrong place in the wrong time. I would agree there that it was the next night would have been better, certainly. The thing that really bothered me about the Austin heel turn was that there was never any explanation given.
Mm-hmm.
It was the start of a bad habit of theirs where they turn somebody heel to do it, and then they have the heel come out and say, I don't have to give you a reason why I did this. You know,
I hate that.
I hate that so much, and that's what we got. And that, I think that was a big failing of it. But there was no real character motivation until afterwards.
Nope.
And let me add to that that after that point, Austin, the world's biggest star, sold more merchandise than everybody, becomes Triple H's bitch. What is that? You know what I mean? Like,
right.
They acted like he was the second in that team, that Triple H was the heavy.
Right, and he didn't really get going until Triple H got hurt. It was really when Austin started to kind of take off in that heel role, was once he was out of the way. So I think there's a lot of truth in that. Keith, you started to mention something with the love triangle thing. I don't know if you finished that point or not.
It's like they really, really dropped the ball on that. Like wrestling's often described as, you know, soap opera for men, and I think that was the first time where they really hit on that, molding it together, because they had women invested in the product and men invested in the product, because this was a storyline that both could relate to. You know, like, it's Kurt Angle's the jerk that's coming in, and he's gonna steal Triple H's woman, and you had this perfect babyface turn for Triple H all set up to go. Because obviously he was trying to do that in the future, and it would have been the best time for it. But the problem was that it would have led to Triple H looking slightly vulnerable at one point, and obviously that can never happen. So they had to flush the whole thing down for him, and it killed 4 months of storylines. Like, it was, I remember we were ordering we were watching the Unforgiven pay per view, waiting for the payoff, and it's just the payoff never came, and it was horribly disappointing.
And it's funny because it's one of those things, and not to pile on my PIC here, but it's one of those things where you maybe want to shake off his internet legend. Oh, yeah, sure, Triple H. Everyone makes Triple H. But, and we had Kevin Kelly on, and we've heard, that is pretty much legitimately the reason why they fucked that storyline up. He didn't want to look vulnerable and have his wife stolen by Kurt Angle. I mean, that was legit the reason they didn't do it.
I think the quote was, the people would never buy that a guy like me would lose a woman to a guy like you, or something to that nature, right? Like, look at you, you're a geek, I'm, you know, Mr. Bodybuilder, you know, and...
but he looks like a Neanderthal.
Right.
Yeah.
And only one of them...
But that's the thing, though. That's why it would have been such a perfect thing.
Right.
Like, because Angle was this geek, and it would have made people even angrier. They would have... They're like, there's no way that he should be, like, stealing the, you know, his woman. Triple H should go kick his ass, and there you go. There's your money, right? Like, it boggles my mind. The very reason why he should have made money was the reason that they bungled it.
And Stephanie was such a great heel at the time, too.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes her character different from, like, the one she's portraying today, my buddy Charles brought this up, is that to me in a phone conversation the other day. The reason she was such a great heel is she wasn't afraid to let The Rock or Jericho or anybody that, you know, she was in a feud with get the upper hand in a promo war, or, you know, or even like leave her there with like a cake on her face,
right,
for lack of a better phrase. You know, whereas now, well, you can't touch Stephanie. You can't, you know, she's there belittling Edge and Daniel Bryan and in a war of words, and they just have to sit there and take it, or the Big Show, you know, or he just sits there and takes it from them. There's no response. Whereas, you know, Jericho would call her a hoe and have the whole arena chanting hoe at her, and you know, and then she would look shaken and upset, whereas now there's no vulnerability. Whereas back then, she was a vulnerable heel.
And I think if you look at it, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm probably going to make the same point you are, but I was going to say that, not to pile on Triple H even more here, but if you look at Vince McMahon, for instance.
Yes.
Vince was all over TV. Yeah, sure. Vince made himself out to be the alpha dog and everything like that. But when it came time for Vince to get his ass kicked, he went out there and people beat his ass for, you know, minutes straight and left him laying on a stretcher and bloodied and you know, pulled out as a wreck of a human being and like that. And, like, yeah, Vince, he took the stink face from Rikishi, I think, to pay off the kiss my ass angle like that. Like, do you think Triple H would ever do that? No.
Yep. That's exactly.
You guys are all so blind. It's not good for business.
That's exactly.
Let me ask you this, though. Will, I'll start with you.
Go for it.
All right. So Triple H turns face after the whole, you know, Kurt stole my woman and everybody feels bad for me. So they pushed that storyline across, and I'll go around the horn. Then I want then Scott and then Matt.
So we're
if they did that
right now.
Yeah, if they did that, because I just can't take this anymore. If they did that, I'm only kidding. If they did that, then who would they have gotten to pay off the Austin got run over by the car angle?
I don't know anybody but Triple H or Rikishi. I mean, fucking The Rock. I mean, the fans were already turning on The Rock, you know? Benoit was right there with Shane McMahon at the time, you know, or Jericho. Hey, Rock, you know, Austin, I needed you out of the way so I could elevate myself.
Benoit, there's an interesting, I've never heard that.
Well, I'm just saying, just as Shane McMahon's lackey, you know, just as part of the whole family, you know, we wanted to get rid of you. We couldn't do it in the ring. Huh. We're going to do it illegally, you know, with the use of, because Shane McMahon was managing Benoit that year, 2000.
Now, could they have, I kind of dig that, though. Like, even though he wasn't with the company, oh, fuck it, that wouldn't
have. No, they could have made another one.
They could have made that up. Scott, what do you think of that?
No, Benoit was with the company in 2000.
Well, no, in 99, though. When
he ran him over. Not when he got ran over. Actually, 99 he wasn't.
When did he get ran over? I thought he got ran, when did he get run over?
Survivor Series 99.
Oh, shit. See, the crash.
He could have still made it work, though.
Nah, that's all right.
But whatever, though. I mean, but the point still remains, though, is that
you can explain
it didn't
that
have
away.
To be Triple H.
Right.
They could have had somebody in there. I mean, you just pick a person, you know. Kurt Angle, when did Kurt Angle debut? Right at that time?
Yeah,
right?
Could have been him. Yep.
Yeah.
There it goes. Hey, you know, I needed, you know, I was fighting for a chance to get on TV. There's no way I would have been on TV if Austin was still on every week. He would have used up my minutes. And once Austin was out, all of a sudden I'm on TV every week.
But and that's what and that's what done. Triple H used as his explanation. But the thing was, he was already on all the time.
Exactly. So it made no sense. And I don't know. It was, you know, and then turn in Rikishi when he was like one of the hottest mid-card acts at the time. It was just a waste.
Well, and there were rumors that they were going to buy WCW in the fall at first, in like October-ish. And maybe if you do that, then maybe use one of their guys to you know, not that they would have probably wanted to put them over, knowing how they handle things eventually. But Keith, I'm curious in your take on all this.
Okay, well, let me throw this one at you, Mick Foley. However, Mick doesn't remember doing it because it was Crazy Cactus Jack who did it, and it, with the years of having his split personalities have left him unable to distinguish between them anymore. So Cactus Jack ran him over, and Mick Foley has like a. You know, some kind of mental breakdown and can't remember doing it. And so, you know, he turns back into crazed killer Cactus Jack to pay off the angle.
I like it.
You
got to
put him back in the ring, though, right?
Yeah.
Well, his retirement only lasted for 6 weeks.
I know. I think he would have made it happen. That I like that idea, and I think that was one of the few times in the company's history that they could have kind of had the team to pull off something kind of I don't say delicate like that, but kind of deep on those lines. Matt, what do you think?
I like all of these ideas, but I would probably say Kurt Angle. Really, I mean, he made his debut at Survivor Series, and who bigger to knock off the, you know, out of the company than Stone Cold Steve Austin? And I mean, who had a better year than Kurt Angle in 2000?
All right. Well, speaking of years in 2000, not which company had the better year, which company had the really, really worst year. And that means it's time to get into WCW. So, Will, take a breath, have a drink, do whatever you got to do to get fired up. We got a lot of WCW to talk about, but I'm going to start things off with Mr. Keith. How much WCW, and I guess we already kind of know the answer just based on your reviews and rants, but how much WCW were you watching and following in those last few months?
Unfortunately, a lot of it, but yeah. I was, of course, reviewing Thunder every week, which was quite the experience in itself.
Yeah,
I didn't really watch much of Nitro. I used to watch it on replay on TSN because it wouldn't air until usually Tuesday afternoon, sometimes even later if I was lucky. And yeah, and of course I had to watch all the pay-per-views and review them. So yeah, I was right in there into the thick of all of it, watching it kind of fall apart week by week.
Were you enjoying it?
I was enjoying it on an ironic, detached, hey, this is great to watch this shithole finally self-destruct after all these weeks of me predicting that it was going to happen level, but I mean, I wasn't really enjoying watching the product as I was watching it, I'd say.
Matt, what were your thoughts? How much WCW were you watching at this time?
I pretty much stopped watching WCW when the Radicals showed up in WWF. I watched maybe like the night after Goldberg turned heel just to see what was going to happen, but that's pretty much it in 2000.
How about you, Scott?
I pretty much stopped after the finger poke. I think I gave up at that point. I thought that was it was just so bad at that point. I guess I poked in and out in 99 during the tournament that they had later on when Brett fought Benoit, Mayhem. Mm-hmm. I kind of paid attention at that point, but middle of the year, and after they ruined the Goldberg streak, that 3 month stretch from like November 98 to January 99 turned me off. And I went full bore into WWF at that point. So I would say right around the turn towards the finger poke and those last, you know, I guess 2 years. I really don't remember watching much.
All right, Will. Ready to unload Valvina style? Go ahead.
No, man. no money shot here, man. But I'm my relationship with WCW, I call it a relationship because WCW got me back into wrestling, man. I'd watched as a kid. Like I was saying earlier, man, I'm not 40, but I'll be 40 soon. And I watched wrestling as a kid up until I got into high school. And then I stopped watching it until the NWO era, you know, 96, 97, when the NWO was hot and all these exciting new wrestlers, Rey Mysterio, Malenko, Benoit, Jericho, just all these guys just coming out of the woodwork, Eddie Guerrero, who I love, you know. So I love WCW. I was a WCW guy. I watched the 1997 WWF product, but I was invested in the WCW product. You know, I watched 1998 WWF, but I was emotionally invested in WCW in 98 up until the second half. And then after that, after that run of pay-per-views, I know Scott Keith knows what I'm talking about, Road Wild, the Dennis Rodman tag pay-per-view, I think, which was the month before Bash at the Beach, then Road Wild, then Fall Brawl
was the worst. That was
just absolute dregs. Then Halloween Havoc. I told myself there's no fucking way I'm buying this pay-per-view because I was buying WCW pay-per-views this whole time. I think I still have the VHS tapes of them when I recorded them. And then Halloween Havoc was like, wow, man, this was a really good show, you know. It was really long, but I wasn't one of the ones who had the main event cut out on me. I got to watch the main event on my cable company. So I saw that. And then they pull you in, and then World War III 98 happens. And that was a shit show. And then Starrcade 98 happens, and the taser. And then the finger poke, and then I was just like, enough of this. And I was still trying to watch wrestling in 99. I was done with WWF. I hate that Vince Russo. I mean, what, 1999 was like Austin's like biggest year or something. You know, I was tuned out. I was not paying attention. Wasn't paying attention to WCW. Then I get on the internet, like I said earlier, so I was discovering this stuff. So I'm still a wrestling fan. I just wasn't watching any product. Then I got into the WWF product as it got better. Almost the minute Russo left, I was glued to WWF TV. And WCW, you know, I would read like the news sites and they'd say, hey, you know, new writer. So you go, you try and watch when Russo comes in and it's a train wreck and it's some of the worst TV you ever watched. Or Kevin Nash's horrible book, and I was done with that. Then when the Radicals left, you had to watch the next night when they throw Arn Anderson out there to explain how the company fucked up, you know, and said that Benoit's foot was under the ropes or Sid's foot was under the ropes during the pin, so it didn't count, you know. And then you watch the reboot with the Bischoff era, then the Goldberg heel turn, and Bischoff, Arquette, all of these assholes went in the title.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm just like, what the fuck did they do to my company? You know, this was my company. You know, I mean, we talk, like, I know, when I listen to y'all's podcast, I mean, y'all review every pay-per-view. You've done, like, how many years? 4 or 5 years in a row of just, like, recapping the years? you're invested in WWF as a company. You know, you probably spend money on it. You know, reading Scott Keith's rants, he was invested in Bret Hart, you know, when all that stuff was going on, you know, and other Canadian wrestlers. You know, I was invested in WCW. That was the company that, you know, basically gave me my hobby back. And then they just fucked it up, man. And by the end, I was like, good riddance. You know, I kind of like Scott Steiner, you know. I was still hoping that they would do something with, like, you know, Rey Mysterio. And then Eddie leaves. And then the Radicals leave. And Jericho leaves. I mean, just everybody left. And good riddance, you know. By the end, by 2001, good. Because you kind of had a hope, hey, Vince McMahon did so much with all of this WCW talent, you know, pushing the Radicals, pushing Jericho, you know, giving them seemingly at the time anyway, an important role in the company, whereas WCW was just so tepid. And you know, why didn't they bring La Park in? That would have been exciting in the invasion. They should have brought La Park in. I guess I liked La Park at the end.
Let me throw this one out there, Matt. And we can go quick on this one. Who do you think and when should they have finally ended the streak?
Well, they had already started to boo him from what you hear. Of course, most of what I've heard, who I've heard that from is Kevin Nash, so it's hard to say. Man, I don't know. I really like the streak, so I really would have liked to see him, you know, hold out a lot longer. But I really haven't thought about who I'd want to see beat him in the streak or how long it should last.
How about you, Keith?
Well, they were still making money off the streak, so there was no reason to end the streak.
Right.
I don't even understand the thinking there. It's like, okay, well, we're still doing really well with this, so let's go out and kill it. Like, that'd be like, you know, Vince ending the Undertaker streak at this point. There's just no point. Like, why would you do it? What are you building towards?
Yeah, I think they did run into a little bit of a problem, though, when they started booking Goldberg against guys like Sting and DDP. I mean, guys who have been in the company for so long.
That should have been their role at that point. They should be putting Goldberg over, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. That should have been everybody's role in the company at that point. Go out there and put them over until you stop making money off them.
Right, but I think they were still, you know, the fans were still going to choose those two guys over Goldberg in a lot of ways. And I think they kind of hurt Goldberg in that way.
But I mean, from my standpoint, I think they could have they could have went out and brought in guys from other other places to do a paycheck Hulk Hogan style for years and years. I mean, look at how long they milked Hogan for, like four mm-hmm. years. Bring in some big fat heel, comes in, injures him for a week. Hogan beats him 18 times around the house show circuit, and then they repeated that for 4 years. Like, they could have kept doing that with Goldberg. Same thing. Bring in Bam Bam Bigelow for a couple of pay-per-view run. He squashes him, moves on. Bring back, I don't know, God, what, like Mike Awesome in that role. Put him out there.
Yeah.
Big bad heel. Boom. Spear. Jackhammer. Done. Move on.
No,
to
he had
guy.
To bang the fat lady, Scott. Come on.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah.
I agree. They should have had him squashing or beating heels. But I mean, I just think that putting him up against Sting and DDP was a mistake.
All right, let me ask you this.
Hold on. I want to.
All right, go.
I would have picked Bret Hart. I would have, you know, Bret Hart was the hottest thing after Montreal, and they kind of screwed that up in '98. You know, but they did the awesome. They did the awesome confrontation in Canada, right, where Goldberg spears him with the metal plate.
Oh yeah, maybe.
That would have been hot, man.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
and he had already broken the and the streak was broken at that point. So imagine if they had kept him still undefeated and they did that.
Right. And the thing about the streak too, I mean, like there were other guys there. Like I know Booker T was a face at the time. Look at the run he had as King Booker. He was really entertaining. I'm not saying that he would have had that same character, but clearly Booker T could do more than just be like Stevie Ray's partner, you know. Or be a quiet guy in the mid card. So you had other heels there to feed them. I mean, WCW had 100 people on their payroll. You didn't even have to go outside, like Keith said. You could have just fed them people on your own roster for, you know, months at a time. But
yeah.
It, you know, then culminate with like Bret Hart in this big game, because he was one of the few guys at the time that I guess before the Owen, that kind of still had it or could have gone with, I don't know. I think it would have been hot at the time. You know,
Bret actually had a really kind of a funny story about that Goldberg match on one of his interviews. I think it was either a Pure or a Shoot interview he did around that time. But he was talking about the circumstances behind it that really kind of sum up WCW then, which is that they brought him out for that. Eric Bischoff pitched the match to him and said, okay, well, we'll do the thing, and Bret pitched the idea of Goldberg spearing him, and Bischoff's like, great, okay, yep. So then after that, Hulk Hogan will come out and beat you up then. And Bret's like, well, why? And Bischoff had no answer to that. And, well, because. Because then Hogan will come out and drop the leg on you, and there we go, and people eat it up. And Bret's like, okay, so what does it lead to? And Bischoff said, nothing, but it'll pop a reading, and people will love it. And, you know, that was WCW in a nutshell right there. They just throw things out there and at the wall with no thought given to it and no mind paid to the money that they could be throwing away.
Well, and you're glad Vince Russo wasn't in there either, because then you would have had three strippers, two drunks, and a midget involved.
Yeah, a car blowing out at the end. Yeah.
Something on a pole, for sure.
Definitely on a pole.
All right, Keith, what was your thoughts when you heard about the rumors here in 01 that Bischoff and Fuchsia Media were going to step in and buy the company for a bit? Did you think there was anything there? Would they have lasted? Is that something you could have seen taken off? Are you excited about it, or are you ready for them just to go away?
Oh, no, I was ready for them to go. Bischoff was so exposed by that point. It was obvious all he could do was rebooting the promotion over and over again, hoping to find something. Or bringing back the NWO over and over again, because that was his one idea that apparently made any money. I mean, look at what TNA turned into under his watch here recently before they finally let him go. Like it's apparent that he was never the idea guy. He was the guy who would bring in other people to take their ideas and you know, put the rubber stamp on them. But I mean, the whole idea that some entertainment company that people looked into and couldn't even figure out what they did was going to come in and save WCW. And I think the rumor was that Rob Van Dam was going to be the big star he was going after to head it up. It was crazy. It's like these guys couldn't make money with Goldberg, Kevin Nash, and Hulk Hogan on top of the company. And you think that Bischoff's going to come in with Rob Van Dam and do anything to save them? Like, I don't think so.
What do you think, Matt?
Well, I mean, like you say, he's never really been a success outside of the NWO angle. And as far as making stars, he never really made any stars outside of Goldberg. And I think if he had bought the company with the investors that he was talking about getting, he never would have been able to afford the contracts for those big stars. So I don't really see where he could have, you know, turned everything around. Especially, I mean, if he had, and like you said, if he had all these other stars already in his company, then why didn't he turn the company around then? I just don't see that it would have been any kind of improvement.
Will, do you agree with that? And if it wasn't Bischoff, could anyone besides Vince have bought WCW at that point and turned things around?
Well, I guess it depends if Bischoff, the owner, you know, is Bischoff the booker, or Bischoff the guy. You know, is he taking on both roles, or does, you know, he let someone else kind of book for him? Like, you know, this is the match I want. Kind of, you know, doing that backward booking that, I guess, Vince McMahon and Pat Patterson, where they'd like know the WrestleMania match a year in advance and say, okay, how do we get there? You know, is he going to have somebody like that? You know, I'm of the firm belief that, you know, after watching, you know, I don't know, thousands of hours of wrestling, that with the right angle, you know, and pushing the right people in the right roles, which I've seen in Memphis, like, you know, I don't want to go real old school on you, but I will. Like, Jimmy Hart in Memphis basically had scrubs in his first family, and every week, you know, he was driving the crowd crazy. Andy Kaufman comes in to Memphis, you know, as a star, and, you know, that's the way you use a celebrity, the way that Memphis used Andy Kaufman. So I think that, you know, I mean, like I said, I brought up Laparca. Laparca's an awesome wrestler. Man, he's still having awesome wrestlers, wrestling matches, you know, this year. You know, Laparca could have been a huge star. I mean, Vince Russo saw it, but you know, used him in a comedy role. But Laparca could have been big if you push him right. You know, I don't buy this thing, and I think Eddie Guerrero proves if they're not white or what was the racist comment Vince Russo made that, you know, Americans don't want to see Mexican and Japanese wrestlers or something, you know, because they don't relate to them. I think it's bullshit, man. I think that if you have charisma, it shows through. I mean, we saw it with Daniel Bryan. You know, they were not actively trying to get Daniel Bryan in a main event role, but the crowd responded. Now, Vince McMahon in 1997 would have heard the crowd and said, holy shit, we have something here. 2013, not so much. So I just believe that, you know, I mean, regardless of specific people, if they were used properly, I think that they could have done something with it. But by that time, man, like I said earlier, man, my divorce from WCW was final. So
I think we're talking a lot about creative, but to be honest, the main problem was the finances in that company were a fucking shit show. I mean, regardless of whether or not somebody was going to buy that company, you've got contracts of the laziest slugs on the face of the earth. Kevin Nash had given up even giving a fuck at that point. I think a lot of those guys were. So, I mean, it's the creative side of it. Yeah, there's so many theories and hypotheses we could talk about. But the brass tacks was, by the time they got to 2001, the finances of that company were a disaster. And who's going to try and clean that mess up before we even think about trying to start over or rebuild a roster when you've got money tied up in guys who they're lucky they showed up, much less wrestled a match.
You know, the crazy thing with that was, though, too, is Meltzer was talking about the finances of it. And he said even if you had fired everybody in the entire roster and at that point and had, you know, had the contracts bought out, then the debt only goes from $60 million to something like $55 million. Like it really wasn't even the talent that was eating up all of the money. It still boggles my mind. How do they lose this much money in that short period of time? Like blowing up the cars and running the expensive Nitro sets and pay per views and everything like that.
Paying for Kiss.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, let's be honest. How much do you think they paid to put one of the greatest rock bands ever to play one song for a fucking mid-card hump, you know, that didn't make much of anything and whose name success was his dad managed the Mets. I mean, you know, really.
And also, too, booking the big arenas sometimes they were running and then having a paper, you know, majority of the crowd. I think that was part of it, too. They were still running some major arenas in 99 and 2000.
Yeah.
And that didn't help, too, because you look, you know, like what Vince would do in the mid-90s, times were tough. He started running barns out in the middle of nowhere. You know, he was running the Westchester County Civic Center. He wasn't running the you know, Georgia Dome. So that was probably a little bit too that added up.
Yeah, but I think that's what a lot of that missing money was. I think a lot of it was investing in silly things and just not minding the store. I mean, I don't even think Bischoff was paying attention to finances at that point. I think he just liked hanging around on his motorcycle and hobnobbing with Hogan's friends, and I don't even think he cared about the checkbook.
Oh, yeah, you know? Bischoff checked out ages and ages before.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
They both were, both Bischoff and Paul Heyman had the same problem for different reasons. Heyman had checkbook issues because he was just incompetent. He couldn't add. Bischoff just stopped caring. I think he thought it was a big running faucet of cash, and that's all right. AOL will sign me a check. That's all right. Or Ted will give me some money. And then he can bounce fucking anything.
Well, that's what's so hilarious about the whole thing is that
Bischoff's
whole resurgence and, you know, with WCW and, you know, Nitro and everything, that was built on this foundation of, oh, well, we're going to do all the stuff that the other guys didn't do right back in the day, right? Like, they went out and spent all this money and did all these drugs and all that. We're going to do the exact opposite because we're totally different from them. And then, of course, the crushing irony is that they went out and did every other thing that the WWF did wrong, and somehow they did it even worse to the point where it killed the whole company.
You wonder, though, if it was his own money, if he did buy, if he would have been a little bit better about it. You know, maybe it was the fact that he knew it was Turner's money and it seemed like a bottomless pit that made him so reckless with it.
Yeah, there is something to that, I think, too. Because, yeah, like it was – that was certainly the reputation of you know, writing some, and every problem that came to came across the desk, he tried to solve by writing a check, basically.
All right, we'll mention a sidebar here. We'll mention Andy Kaufman, of course, in the news the last couple of days. His brother coming out and saying he thinks he's still alive and all this other stuff. Is there any chance this guy's alive, Will? Any chance?
No.
Okay.
He would have pissed somebody off. Somebody would have killed him by now.
Right? I mean, there's no way he could have gone 20 years and never have shown back up.
Some huge Taxi fan would have got really mad, I'm sure.
Yes. Come get me, Lekka. All right.
Where did that come from? Was it just me mentioning Andy Kaufman?
Yeah, because I was reading about it today, and then you mentioned it.
That's wild, man. I did not read about that.
You didn't see this? Yeah, it's on like CNN.com and stuff. His brother, Kaufman's brother, said he's still alive because he met Kaufman had left a note or something that said in 1990 or not, what was it, 99 or 2000 or some shit, like to come meet me at some restaurant, and he went and someone came and gave him a note or something, and then he met his daughter that was born 5 years after he would have died, and it's all this crazy shit. It just came out the last couple of days. It's really weird, so go Google it. You'll find it. All right, Matt, was it smart the amount of young talent WCW was featuring? Did you feel like in 2001 they were finally starting to get it, and they were turning the tide a little bit as far as the quality of their programming?
No, I thought it was too little too late. They should have been doing this years before. And even the guys that they did try to turn stars, they would never, you know, put them in main event matches or really give them any featured airtime. So I just think it was too little too late.
All right, how about you, Keith? Because you were watching week in and week out. I mean, did you see a noticeable uptick in the quality of the shows in January, February, March, and the who they were, featuring?
Yeah, they're featuring the guys in opening matches, like the three count, but I mean, even then, like, they couldn't do that, right? Because they'd have Evan Courageous mixed in there, you know. And just, it was okay for opening match stuff and whatever role that they had AJ Styles in there with the Cruiserweight tag team titles or something like that. But yeah, it was definitely too little too late, because the guys who were on top were still the same slugs like Sid and Rick Steiner and, you know, and the kind of thing where it was going to sink the company no matter what.
What do you think, Will?
A lot of this stuff I watched years later after, like, you know, collecting DVDs and VHS tapes of it. And so looking back on it, I think that at least there was a direction. You know, it was Scott Steiner mauling through people. You know, that was the direction, right? I think that was the direction. Somebody was supposed to come back. Goldberg was supposed to come back, and they were supposed to, like, do a big face-off to finally. And if Bischoff would have actually bought the company and they stayed on Turner's network, wasn't that the idea that, like, eventually Goldberg comes back and then they do the big Goldberg-Steiner thing? Because Steiner had, like, killed off all the
right.
legends or the top dogs.
Yep.
So, actually, you know, I think that, you know, as a book and direction isn't bad, you know? I mean, it wasn't like, you know, in 1997, the Hart Austin feud mixed in with the little HBK, where they're still getting beat in the ratings, but, you know, you can tell that there's this, like, swell of support for that product that's building and building, you know, even though WCW was still winning the war, you know? But at least the direction was there. So I think that, you know, I mean, we've seen good stretch runs from most wrestling companies. I mean, you know, just go back. I mean, like, WCW, we keep thinking about how horrible the end was, and it was horrible. But WCW, you know, ever since Turner bought it, has never been run properly, ever. You know? I mean, you bring in all these guys, Herd, Fry, Watts, Bischoff, it didn't matter. You know? Like, they were always a badly run company, you know. It's almost like I want Brian Alvarez to write the prequel to Death of WCW called, you know, Every Single Year, you know, and just look at it, because every year they fucked up somewhere. Whether it's in 89, who was it? Was it George Scott, who didn't, like, promote the Flair Steamboat match in the Superdome because he didn't want to ruin the house show business or something? And then in 91, it was the We Won Flair deal, you know, and then in 93, it was Bill Watts cutting off the nuts of the cruiser, or 92, cutting off the nuts of the cruisers, and, you know, and, or was that 93? I don't know. Whatever. The point remains. You know, 94, it was, you know, basically Hogan comes in, brings every single one of his horrible wrestling friends in with him, and kills the product that was just like we talked about it earlier on the show with those hot pay-per-views. Just kills it dead, man. I mean, to where, you know, one of the best years of pay-per-view ever ends up is like, eh, you know, well, the first, we have the first half, you know, and so, you know, I think, I mean, I don't want to say they could never turn the ship around, but, you know, I mean, who are they going to have with that vision? If it's Bischoff, then no. If it's somebody that Bischoff puts in a position of power, maybe. You know, we've seen it in the past. So, I don't know. I don't know. I'd be interested to hear what everyone else has to think about that.
Well, and I want to disqualify all this because I feel like there's this thought out there from some people that read and listen to things, and they think everyone's just here to shit and bury WCW. And I feel like we all speak out of love of WCW in a way that it kills us to have seen it get to the point where it did. So I don't want people to read or listen to this and think, oh, here's another show just crapping on all the stupid things WCW did. Because, I know that's not what you mean. I know that's not what you're thinking. As you said, this was your promotion, and it killed you to see some of this stuff.
It bothers me now when WWE craps on WCW, I have to say.
Right.
It's like, because they own it. You know, like why would you do that? You know, it's, I don't know, just it as much as you know, I had a love-hate relationship with them over the years, personally. Like I never had money invested in anything like that. But here's WWE. They're putting out their web shows, and you know, with this hashtag, what is it, WCW ruins everything. And it's like, how much money have they made off them in DVD sales over the past few years? You know, let's have a little bit of respect for the dead. You know, like, especially because you're still making money off it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but even the Turner Home Video was a fucking mess. Chopping pay-per-views up the bids. Even the whole video was a mess. Putting the wrong stars on the cover, you know? God, man, what a... Oh. Anyway, sorry, continue.
And a perfect example of that is... I don't remember when this was. I mean, it was a couple months ago. WWE.com, they love to poke shots at WCW. They did one of their goofy top 10s. I think it was top 10 worst pay-per-view posters. And I think 8 of the 10 were WCW. I think the only two WWF ones they made fun of was Backlash 2001, which had Triple H in the front, which I was incredibly offended. And the other was, I think it was that awful Capital Punishment with Obama's caricature with that big Cena head. And that was brutal. But everyone, all the other 8. Now, mind you, let's be honest. Yeah, they get slammed, but they bring it a lot of times on themselves. You know, there was that Great American Bash. What was it, 2000? A lot of the ones they made fun of were like 99 and 2000, which were all pretty. There's like one that just has Buff Bagwell's face on it. I think it was Slamboree. I don't know. The point is I think do it to laugh at themselves.
My favorite, though, with WCW was what was it? Fall Brawl 99, I think it was, where they didn't have a main event until the Nitro before the show.
Yes.
And so all the advertising was like top secret. Like,
we don't even know what it's going to be, but it's going to be great.
We don't know what it's going to be. Like, that's great. Yeah, I'm going to spend my money on that, guys.
We promise ICP will be on. Trust us. So, Keith, you were obviously, and Matt, I want to get your two takes as well. As you said, you went back and watched a lot of this stuff. But what were your thoughts at the time? When do you think WCW knew they were fucked? Could you tell? When did you think they were fucked?
When the Radicals left. Oh, boy. Once Chris Benoit showed up on WWE TV in 2000, it was like, well, there goes the entire mid-card. And you could tell things were circling the drain at that point. I think putting the world title on Sid was also kind of a bad sign. Oh. That's usually a downturn for the promotion when that happens. And then probably Eric Bischoff and Vince Russo coming out on TV and saying, well, forget everything that happened in the first 4 months of the promotion. We're starting over again from scratch because the product sucks so much.
Let me ask you guys.
There's a good message to send to your fan base. Be like, hey, guys, all the stuff you've watched for the last 4 months, even we think it's shit.
Sorry.
But then they made it even worse. Yeah. That's the irony. They made it worse than it was. They should have just left it alone and just, it would have just been shit. Not huge.
Yeah, all this was terrible, but we're going to put the world title on David Arquette now and everything will be much better.
Oh, God. Do you think that Do you think that Mayhem 90, the tournament that culminated at Mayhem, if Benoit had won instead of Brett, do you think that would have made any kind of difference? Anybody can answer this. Does he think that it would have made any kind of difference?
No, they had to get the world title on Brett just to get some kind of pay benefit out of him. And at that point, I think, like, he'd been there for 2 years without them drawing a dime off of him. So I mean, like, really, you had to make him the top guy in the promotion considering the kind of money that they were paying him.
Right. If anything, they waited too long to pull the trigger, for sure. I mean, well, I know the Owen thing kind of mucked up the middle of the year for him, but I guess he had all of 98. So, yeah, I don't know. They fucked him up. That's one they really
screwed. They should have put the world title on him like a month after he got in there in 1997. Yeah. Like, how stupid do you have to be to not be able to write that storyline?
Well, it was bad timing with that because they were just paying off the Sting Hogan thing. So it was like, of all the worst times, any other time he came in, they probably could have pulled it off. But like that was like the worst month for him to enter as far as WCW actually having a plan and having a big money match. Matt, you want to take a stab at that question? I kind of lost my train of thought there, but when did you know they were fucked?
Well, as far as TV wise, I would agree. You know, when the Radicals left, I mean, that's certainly when I stopped watching, like I said earlier. But I mean, you kind of had to know if you were, you know, in the know at the time that when Ted Turner was gone and when he no longer really owned the company and the AOL Time Warner merger took place, you kind of had to think, well, you know, since he's gone, he's really the champion of WCW. You kind of think the handwriting's on the wall here. You know, if no one's really going to fight for WCW and the only people that are looking at this are business people and not wrestling people, then you kind of got to have a feel that, you know, something's – if something doesn't turn around, this company is not going to be here for very much longer.
All right, Will, I'm going to ask you this one. Why couldn't they find another time slot somewhere? I mean, at that point, wrestling was still pretty hot, right? WWF pulling in big ratings, and even WCW's ratings at the time weren't awful. Why do you think they had such a hard time finding TV slots?
Like before WWE bought them, or
Before and after, because obviously TNT was going to cancel them, and Bischoff had a hard time. You know, he wasn't able to secure television, and then Vince struggled even to get them on TV.
Yeah, no, that has to do with the advertising money, man. At least the model of you make money off the advertisers, and wrestling brings in a lowbrow group like us. So, you know, you're not gonna. I mean, that's kind of obvious, isn't it? I mean, it's popular programming, but it doesn't bring in high dollar advertisers. So, you know, why would a company want them unless they wanted that ratings push like Spike did? But at the time, Spike had WWF. They didn't need the very, very distant number two company. And what, right? USA's management at the time didn't want them. So where are they going? You know, there's no appeal to having the number two product, you know, that's not going to earn you any money with advertising revenue. So what's the point? That's the only reason I've read over the years. There's no other reason, right? The lowbrow audience it draws that creates a lack of high-dollar advertising.
Were their ratings that bad at the time, though? I thought they were around like a 2 or 2.5.
Yeah, the ratings were fine, but I guess, you know, to Will's point, the ratings didn't correlate to people who were spending money on the advertising, you know, the products that they
right.
were advertising.
Right.
Right. Even WWF, like at its biggest point, right, it was all Stacker 2 commercials, right?
That's true.
That's it. I mean,
Chef
Boyardee.
You
know,
yeah,
Chef
Boyardee.
Chef Boyardee, you know? Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
the big,
even now, advertising revenue isn't really much of a stream for WWE. Like, it's for the longest time, they were sending all the advertising money they got to USA, basically. I think, in fact, they still are.
Yeah, that's part of the deal, I think, right? They get paid for the program, but they gave up the advertising.
Exactly, yeah. The TV rights fee is where all the money comes in for WWE. Like, advertising even now is, like, nothing as far as revenue goes for wrestling.
So maybe
back then it was a big deal, right?
Yeah, back then it was because they got hit hard when the PTC came after them in '99. They lost some big sponsors. It was like Coke and a couple other ones that they had that were hurting. But WCW had some decent sponsors. Man, they had the whole Surge thing going on, which I believe is a Coke product. So they had some decent sponsors at the time. But I guess as the ratings started to dip, that was fading away. I mean, do you think it was a shit timing on their point? Like, if this, I was like 5 years later when the cable TV boom was really in full force. I mean, they might have had a better chance to find another network now with so many niche networks out there. If this happened today, I think they'd land somewhere. I mean, fuck, TNA is still alive, you know?
Well, if it happened today, they'd end up on FX or something like that in a second. Like, I don't know if FX was around back then, but, like, the cable nets landscape is totally different today than it was back in 2000, right? Now you got Netflix and a million other things competing for eyes, and if a program came along that was drawing at, you know, a 2.5 week in and week out, even at their lowest level, and even having, you know, a $60 million loss in the hole to bring them along with it, like, yeah, one of these networks would jump on it in a second, like, Fox Sports 1 would be all over that shit.
FX debuted in 94, so they were actually, they were around. I think they were in the talks a little bit when they were shopping around. I seem to remember FX being, you know, bandied about. Because there were talks that maybe they'd get like specials on Fox and stuff, weren't there? And actually, WCW was rumored for NBC specials, I think, at one point.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. That's when Bischoff really started going off the rails, actually, because he was he got really involved with doing the NBC stuff and stopped paying attention to the product, and then ironically, the product went down the tubes and NBC lost interest really fast.
All right, Matt, this may be an obvious one, but which stars were hurt the most when WCW was purchased by Vince?
Well, definitely the younger talent, actually probably some of the mid card guys too, like, Disco and Buff. Yeah, I mean, it's, and the Luchadors, a lot of those guys, they might have already been cut though, right? By 2001. It's basically, I would say, just the younger talent guys.
What do you think, Will?
The correct answer is Jeff Jarrett.
Right.
There's no way that motherfucker is getting a job, you know. That's why we have TNA today. He had to create his own promotion to wrestle in the U.S.
I tell you, it's funny. Yeah. It's funny you mention him, Will, because I just threw in a couple days ago because I forgot I had it, actually. I have the four-disc King of the Mountain set that that Jarrett – I didn't pay for it, so that I've never hated Jarrett. I don't have a problem with him. It's got a lot of matches on it. So, I mean, for just quantity's sakes, it's not that bad. But he kisses Vince's ass throughout that whole thing. He never says a bad – you could tell it's like, you know, please take me back. Somebody else could have this. Please take me back. It almost feels like it. But, I agree. I agree with you, Matt. I think certain mid-carders – suffer. The main event guys could give two fucking shits because no one's going to buy their deal. So they were getting paid through the you know, Goldberg, Nash, all those guys. I agree with you, Scott, that it wasn't a lot of money, but it was enough for them that they could just sit on their lazy asses and not do anything. So they didn't give a crap. The lower guys, I mean, a lot of them came – they either came through already or it's hard to pick out who kind of suffered too because the low guys that were on the cheap, they brought in. And the high-paying guys didn't give a shit, so they went home. But, yeah, like Inferno, Jarrett, select mid-carders that were still
Lex
working.
Luger was another one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, that were working still, weren't quite at that Goldberg-Nash level of contract, but weren't cheap enough and whose reps weren't clean enough that they just enveloped them in, like the Canyons and the Kidmans and those kind of guys.
Right.
That just came in. That was the press. Probably aren't that many, in my opinion, that suffered in the end.
Yeah, I think Luger's
Sting didn't care.
I think Luger's a good one, Will, because he was kind of in between. Like Scott mentioned, you got the guy who's making the big money, and then the guy's kind of dirt cheap. And Luger had burnt a bridge, was probably making decent money, and didn't really completely fit. Even though, and yeah, it was a guy on your board that's going through the stretch of WCW. I mean, Luger seemed to be rejuvenated a little bit in 2000, doing the total package stuff and kind of working well in that role. So maybe he could have came in and had a little bit of a run, but I mean, he's one of the guys that when WCW died, it pretty much ended his career as a result.
Oh, it was done. And then Elizabeth died after then. It was, you know, complete mess. The health problems and everything else. Yeah. Actually, I don't wish ill on anyone like that, you know, but I mean, who knows what really happened, but to me, that's a tragic figure right there.
Elizabeth? Or Luger.
Oh, yeah, of course, Elizabeth. Yeah. She's dead, man. She's not coming back. But no, Luger, man, to me, that's just kind of a tragedy.
Yeah.
You know, the way that, I mean, I just looking at the physical state he's in and the way it collapsed, you know, and I guess he was one of the guys, right, that nobody really has a kind word to say about Luger in the wrestling business, at least, during those times. I'm not saying now or, you know, whatever. But I'm saying at those times, nobody liked Lex Luger, man. And, you know, I mean, he kind of reaped what he sowed, like, you know, 10 times over. You know, it's, you know, to me, I don't know, man. I just, it makes me uneasy to, like, think of Luger or what happened to him. You know, first with Elizabeth, because, you know, that's part of my childhood, Miss Elizabeth. And then what actually happened to Luger and his health and, you know, just the way he deteriorated. So, sad, man.
All right, Keith, who do you think, maybe someone that we haven't mentioned yet, that was really just damaged completely by the death of WCW?
Well, basically everybody's been buried on the last episode of Nitro there. I think would be you know, whether you're Jeff Jarrett, you're Lex Luger, you're Goldust. Those kind of guys, that the in-betweeners, like the guys at the lower end of it, they would just go back and do the indies anyway, right? Like,
right.
It wasn't like they were taking a huge hit to their paycheck, and obviously, like, in fact, it kind of benefited guys like Goldberg, because then he could just collect the money and didn't have to do the job anyway. Right? And he could sit at home and make more money than he was doing with WCW anyway, because he didn't have to pay travel expenses or anything like that anymore. But yeah, definitely it was just kind of, it was the middle guys, or like, you know, like your Shane Douglas and your Conan's, the one who had already tried to get a job and failed in the first place.
Yep.
Right. So yeah, those guys in that kind of that in the middle ground, they're the ones that are pretty much lost their day to day revenue stream.
I will.
Savage.
Yep, God, Scott.
What about Savage?
Well, he was done at that point anyway.
Yeah, he was done. He was still collecting guaranteed money anyway, though.
But I mean, that was probably the best time.
I'm sorry, go.
No, go ahead. No, go ahead, Will. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, with Conan, I mean, Conan was a legend in Mexico. You know, Conan was going to rebound, you know? I mean, I don't know if he went to Mexico after that. I don't really know what he did.
Yeah.
I know he did some indies and eventually landed in TNA, but Conan was going to be fine. Savage was going to be fine. You know what I mean? Savage was it came out, at least I know after his death, that, you know, he's really tight with his money.
Oh, yeah.
And, So, I mean, you know, when Savage left, I mean, he's not really hurt, right? He's not on the way up. You know, now Jeff Jarrett, I guess you could say, well, he's his daddy was rich. He grew up rich, Silverstone. So, but, you know, who knows how much of that money still left? I mean, wrestling promoters, you know, lose their money all the time, you know? So I don't want to just say that, you know, Jarrett was okay with or without it. Who knows? You know, but I don't know. I don't look at Savage and Conan and feel bad for them when WCW left.
Right.
You know? Sorry.
I still think that Savage had, I don't know what he had left per se, but
I mean, after that injury in like 98, he was pretty much done. When he came back in 99, he didn't have much left in the tank. I mean, he was juiced out of his mind and was just barely hobbling around the ring through that last run that he had.
It was morbidly awesome, though, seeing him go to the top rope and doing the elbow, where he'd done it for so many years where, you know, people would, like, say that they could hardly feel it. And here he is coming off the top rope all, you know, fucking just, you know, and coming off and
people.
Just killing people with it because his knees were so damaged that he couldn't, like, break the fall for the victim anymore, man. So, yeah, that was kind of fun watching that, you know. But
just crushing guys.
Like, yeah, crushing them. So.
Will, where were you when you heard Vince bought WCW? Do you remember?
I was in college, man. I was in a computer lab because I didn't have my own computer at the time. I was a poor college student, man, you know. And because I'd switched majors, so I had to go to college much longer than I wanted to. But whatever. Yeah, let's not dwell on that. But I was in the college computer lab. I was reading one of the news sites, man, and hey, you know, make sure you watch the last episode of Nitro, you know, because Vince McMahon bought it. I'm like, holy shit, you know, okay, cool. You know, let's watch this. So I was there, glued to the TV that night, man, flipping back and forth, you know. Now I would just DVR it, but, you know, you can't do that, you know, back in 2001.
How about you, Keith? Where were you? And do you remember the rumors that they were going to buy it back in 2000? Do you remember that part of it?
Oh, yeah. Well, they were making serious attempts to do it back in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
People thought it was going to happen, and then it kind of fell through because of, I can't remember what it was. Something with due diligence happened. Something to do with the Viacom exclusivity deal, actually, because Vince wanted to buy it and put it and keep it going on TBS
right.
as a separate entity, right?
I think so.
And
I think you're right.
Yeah, Viacom stepped in and squashed it, and then that's when the fusion rumors start. And then when Vince bought it, and then the second time Vince bought it, it was just basically he was just buying the assets of the company and the tape library instead of buying it with the intention of running it as a separate show. Yeah.
Now, here's where sleeping at the wheel is the biggest excuse. In mid-2000, when it was pretty much almost a given that Raw was leaving for TNN, didn't anybody in WCW think, unless there's a contractual or a legal thing that I'm missing here, didn't anybody in WCW think maybe we can take over the slot on USA?
I don't think USA wanted wrestling anymore. They were done with it.
Yeah, they had a new
GM or something.
Well,
yeah,
that's the case.
Because Bonnie Hammer was out, right? And she was the big
right.
Yeah.
Big wrestling, yeah.
Yeah, now they have them on. Now they're back and they're on 3 hours. Yeah. Brilliant.
Well, she's but, VKM's yeah. buddy Rod Perth was long gone. So Scott, Keith, where were you when you heard in 01 that it was purchased? Obviously, sitting down prepping to watch Nitro.
Yeah, pretty much. That came out of nowhere. Like that was literally like one day you just log on and oh yeah, Vince bought WCW. Like I don't think anybody expected the end to come as quickly as it did, for sure. I remember I think I was still doing my own site. I can't remember if I was on there yet or not. But yeah, I was just kind of logged onto Meltzer's site one day. Yeah, that was it. And done deal.
How about you, Matt?
Subscribe for the Observer again.
I was 14 years old at the time, so I was at home watching Raw with my dad. And you know, at the beginning of the show, Vince comes on the show and says, you know, he now owns WCW. So
you didn't even know before you turned it on, then?
Yeah, I had no idea. But I flipped over to Nitro, and it was probably the first time in probably 8 or 9 months that I'd watched it at all. So.
Do you think it was a smart decision, Scott, in the end, Vince, to purchase Chris Cola?
For Vince to buy it? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Look at the library. He's making money hand over fist. I think it was you that said it, Scott. He's probably – or maybe it was you, Will. He made more money off – I'm looking at my DVD collection, most of it, in front of me right now, and at least every other DVD that I'm looking at right now has at least one WCW or NWA match on it. I mean, you've got the Essential Starcade. You've got the Dusty DVD. You got the Jake DVD. You got Eddie's. You got Ray's. You got two Nitros. You got Steamboat.
Right.
Jericho.
Bloodbath.
Bloodbath. Allied Powers. You've got RVD. Well, RVD. Well, he's got one match on there. Foley. You've got the Latter.
Okay. Yeah, we got it.
Et cetera, et cetera. Hey,
hold on, man. You forgot the biggest one, man. The Ultimate Ric Flair collection. Now I'm looking at my collection here.
Yep, I got it right there. See, look at where I started. Let's keep going. How about – no, I'm only kidding. But, I mean, the point is all the almost every DVD
right.
that they've put out in the last, like, 7 years has at least one NWA or WCW match on it. And that enough is getting people to buy stuff. Look at that, Rick. We were going crazy when the Ultimate Ric Flair collection came out, and that thing was a formatted piece of – well, I actually – Scott, I was just reading your review of that yesterday. It's one of my favorite – rants you did when you reviewed that original three disc of Flair 6 5-star matches, but formatically that DVD is the pits compared to what they've done now. But that alone was crazy because you know WCW obviously weren't delving into DVDs much at that point. I don't think they ever did any really.
No, they never did. They died before the DVD era started.
Yeah. So, but your review of that is amazing of that set and. You know, and they didn't even know how to – WWF really didn't even know how to do comps at that point. I think people were taping comps better than they were making DVD sets, but they dived right into the pool.
Now they just put everything on YouTube, which blows my mind. Could you imagine if YouTube had been around like this back in, like, the 90s when people were trading tapes on online and like that? Like, I go there just – check the channel, and here's a 5-star match. We're just going to throw it here for free. Right. Like, well, holy shit!
And this is where I'll give the plug for Will's episode they did about the network. That was so great. So many possibilities there as well. And I think we may have lost Will. We'll get him back here. But so, Keith, let me ask you this then. Was this a wise decision on Vince's part at the time the way he did it? Or do you think he would have been better off if he could have pulled it off back in October and kept the TV?
Well, he was still intending to run the TV even when he did the purchase the way he did. The idea was originally going to be Raw and SmackDown split up like an actual brand split, right? Raw was going to become the WCW show, and SmackDown was going to be a WWF show. And I forget how the division was going to be, but my friend Ed Kofsky was sending me info on a weekly basis as it was going down, which was kind of cool. And so it was going to work out like, oh god, it was going to be like Triple H and Undertaker were going to be on one show, and Rock and Austin were going to be on the other show, or something like that.
Yeah, that definitely sounds. Yeah,
I can't remember how it was going to go down exactly, and for whatever reason it fell through with because of the Buff Bagwell Booker T match basically, which sunk the whole thing in one shot. But it was a cool idea. Like he really did try to resurrect WCW in that form, and I think he could have gotten a lot of juice out of it if he could have done it like that.
So, Will, the question we just asked Keith there was, was it wise in the end for him to have bought it, and do you think it would have been better off if he could have pulled it off back in October? And if Viacom hadn't blocked the deal and he was able to keep the TBS time slots, could Vince have salvaged things back then?
Yeah, I think he could have pulled it off. I think what you would have seen is a lot what you see now with the Raw and SmackDown brands. That's what you'd have, except it'd be WWE and WCW. You know, it was the booking of the invasion sucked, you know, but I don't think that they needed any other new talent. I think that they had plenty of time. Just having DDP there, if you would have just accepted DDP, I thought they could have gotten a lot of traction with that.
Right.
You know? So, I mean, I what was the second question?
Was it smart that he did it, and could it have been better if he did it in October?
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, October 2000 or 2001?
2000, where he was supposed to buy it, and Viacom, you know, reportedly blocked the deal.
Oh, okay. I think it would have been much better in October 2000. Leading to WrestleMania, I think it would have been much better because then your invasion angle, you know, hopefully it would have been written a little better, right?
Right.
You know, I don't know what the contracts were like in October 2000. I don't know if the talent would have been different, you know. But leading into WrestleMania, you probably would have had a huge WrestleMania. WWF versus WCW at WrestleMania, that would have been insanely off. I don't know match quality-wise what we would have gotten. You know, who knows? I mean, you know, who knows? Depending on what talent and who was placed with who. But, yeah, I think in October, it would have been huge.
Look at the Invasion pay-per-view, which is like one of the worst promoted, biggest piece of shit that they ever did, and it still drew one of the biggest buy rates in North American history.
Yeah.
Like, it was unscrew-upable.
Yep. They did huge money for that. Let's talk about this quick, and Matt, I'll ask you first. We talked about this last week on RX7 and on when we chatted with Brian Shields. Just how fucking crazy it was that all this happened, the go-home Raw to WrestleMania 17. Their biggest WrestleMania in history. They had the go-home build, and now they're dealing with the final Nitro and the integration of WCW, and they're trying to push all these other angles. And isn't it just crazy the way it timed out to be that week?
Yeah, I don't really have a lot to say on it. But, yeah, it was really, really strange. Almost convenient, really, the way it – because I guess they figured, well, you know, if WCW's gone, then all the people who were watching it would flip over to Raw and they would, you know, hopefully buy WrestleMania 17, maybe. I don't know. It really was crazy, though.
Yeah, what do you think, Will, of it being that week? I mean, just adding to all the chaos heading into Mania.
Well, you know, I mean, go back into fantasy booking about, like, when we were talking earlier about the Austin Hill turn. I mean, could you imagine that instead of Austin turning heel, that's when you debut DDP and he comes in and Diamond cuts Austin? Or, you know, I mean, him and Austin were friends. They went up on the road together, if you believe Austin on his podcast. Have his buddy come in and Diamond cut him. Holy shit, that would have gotten some heat. That would have been your memorable ending. You still would have had the great Austin Rock match, you know. And then you kick off the invasion right there instead of just having guys casually come in week after week like Lance Storm doing super kicks or whatever. You know, I don't know. I think that, you know, that happened in that week actually hurt the invasion with them not capitalizing on it right away, you know, and doing something huge that week with it. They did the huge send-off, but then it sits, right? Like, when did Lance Storm finally come in and do a super kick?
It was May, late May by the time he did that.
Yeah.
And when did Booker T come and hurt Austin?
King of the Ring.
June. So, yeah. So, I mean, think about these big things that happened months after they ran their course with the power trip, you know, when they could have just jumped right into that WCW thing, guns blazing, when it was fresh on everybody's mind. By this time, everybody that had stopped watching WCW and did not go over to the WWF, which was, well, everybody who was watching it, right? Because they didn't get any uptick in ratings or anything, right? Like, at all.
Right.
Am I wrong in this?
No, I think you're right. I don't think it was much. Yep.
There's nothing there, so why not immediately feature the people that this, you know, 2 million or 1.5 million or 3 million or however millions of people were watching WCW still, why not immediately put them in the mix?
Yeah, they definitely lost a lot of momentum, that's for sure. And Keith, I think you can back me up on this. Backlash and Judgment Day kind of sucked overall, especially in the main events. So there was a spot for these guys.
Yeah, like I think really as far as the purchase goes, they didn't even need to bring hardly anybody in. They should have actually sunk all their money into getting Goldberg to come in and done the match with Austin, and boom, there you go. You recoup every cent of the money that you paid for WCW with one match.
But do you disagree that they could have immediately, I mean, because it's clear, right, DDP?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They could have immediately.
Yeah, it was weird. Like, they brought in the WCW guys, and they literally had them sitting, where was it, in, like, a skybox?
They didn't have, like, a camera up there.
They didn't have a camera. There was a Chiron that said WCW wrestlers in very tiny little letters, right? And there's, you know, there's your $5 million investment. Great to go, guys.
Yeah, man. To me, the big thing there is, like, you said bring Goldberg in. Fuck, dude, I keep harping on La Parca because, you know, I love La Parca. Bring fucking La Parca in. It doesn't fucking matter. You book him right. La Parca's charismatic. He's going to get over. Bring my man El Dandy in. El Dandy's one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. You have El Dandy punch fucking Kurt Angle. They're about the same fucking size. You know, they would have a great match. It doesn't matter. You know, just keep WCW on everybody's lips. Immediately.
That's what it was. It was all about the presentation. It wasn't about who you had and what you had. Right. Is this all about making them look strong?
It matters who you have in the sense that, like, you know, I mean, if you're putting on shitty matches, you know, month after month after month, I mean, because, like, look, during that Russo era, they had the talent, right? They did. The presentation sucked. But I'm not just talking about the angles. I'm saying just the in-ring product was the shits because of Russo's philosophy. You know, I mean, you weren't going to have to worry about that in WWF. I mean, but the way they did it was just so anticlimactic. And y'all are going to talk about that when next week, the actual invasion?
Not a couple weeks. We got Backlash still we're up to, so it'll be a little bit before.
So you get to dwell on the Power Trip era.
Oh, Scott is ready. Scott's he's so damn excited. It's
I cannot wait.
Oh, man. Ugh.
He loves this.
Can't
fun,
wait,
you know, but. I'd be so much more excited to listen to that if it was the WCW invasion kicks off with DDP versus Austin era, you know, but it wasn't. So,
all right, so let's.
So I was just going to say, like, someone brought up that Booker Buff Bagwell match. They could have survived that, man. People were accustomed to watching shitty matches. I mean, it sucks that it happened the first night. I mean, then the next night Booker T has like a good match with Kurt Angle, right? Or like the next week or something. So it's not like they couldn't survive that. Yeah,
they didn't want to survive it.
No, they didn't.
That was totally a case of it was. They wanted to kill it. They were looking for any excuse to not have it work. And yeah, like
they picked the
WWE is the only way. And blah blah blah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, picking Booker was fine, obviously, but you know, if they wanted to really throw a stinker, they picked the most popular or the most well-known talentless sloth on the face of the earth to put in that match.
Well, yeah.
Hold on. I'm going to defend Buff Bagwell here. Because remember when Vince was doing his little thumbs up, thumbs down? Buff Bagwell got one of the biggest pops.
Yep.
And that, I think that they put Buff Bagwell in there to see how the crowd would react to him. You know, doing it in Tacoma, Washington, maybe not. But still,
exactly.
They put him in there because he did get one of the biggest pops, and he did have the body, and he is kind of like their type of guy, right? You know?
Yeah, but then they sabotaged him right out of the gate, too. They were Buff tells a story about how he's – for that match, actually, they worked everything out in advance, and when he was walking by the gorilla position, whoever was the agent there told him, okay, by the way, don't play to the camera or do anything you did in WCW when you go out there. And Buff's like, what the fuck? You know, like we've just been flying this out for like the past half hour, and you're taking away my entire entrance and you know, the way that I get myself over.
Yeah, but that's coming from a wrestler, and I'm not trying to say anything. I mean, bad about wrestlers.
Are
but
you
I
disparaging
will.
The moral fiber of Buff Bagwell now? Is that what you're
saying? I'm saying that if they go out there and follow the agent's advice and it gets over, then Buff Bagwell is going to take credit for being awesome and saying how he wanted to do a new direction from his WCW character, and this was his WWF character, and that they were trying to tell him to be the old Buff the Stuff, but I wanted to prove that I was more than Buff the Stuff, you know? And I'm just saying that it's a disaster and a failure now, but at the time, I don't think Buff Bagwell knew it was going to be a disaster. I don't buy that, man. I really don't. I think that's Buff saying, oh, well, they set us up to fail. I don't buy that. I think that the fact that they had money, and I think that once it failed, I think that's when Vince kind of and then once Booker T injures Austin on his very first interference,
yeah.
Right? That's when Vince kind of goes like, these guys need some time in developmental that we don't really even have set up yet. But, you know, I guess they had OVW and HW. Never mind. But,
Memphis,
you know,
I think they had Memphis.
They didn't have the performance center then. So, you know, maybe they need some time in the future performance center. But I think that's when they turned it to say, fuck, we're not putting these guys over. We're going to kill this thing, salvage what we can out of it, move on.
Well,
I think that's when that happened.
And I think you nailed a big part of it, Will, in where it was. I mean, Tacoma, Washington, not a big WCW place. These people weren't paying money, in theory, to see a WCW main event, right? Because Raw was still so hot. They were paying to see Austin and Angle and Triple H and, you know, all these other guys. They didn't want any part of Buff Bagwell. I mean, there's a reason they were at a WWF event. That's a match you
can I challenge that, too?
Yeah.
Even though I brought it up? And that WCW was fucking, when it was hot all over the country, man.
Yeah,
you
they weren't
I mean?
Hot in 2001.
No, I know that, but what I'm saying though is that they were still hot. I mean, I've been to plenty of shows where you can like kind of send the fans home happy with a dark match that doesn't air on TV. You know, I mean, they could have advertised Stone Cold versus
I guess my point is
they
were dead for that match though. I just don't think that crowd on that night did not seem interested in that match. And I think that's a match maybe you put in Atlanta or in Greensboro or something. At least give yourself a chance.
Sure.
You know, at least give yourself a chance. I mean, maybe it still bombs there, but at least you're being smart about it. It's like when they had Mick Foley and the Terry Funk and Tommy Dreamer shit in 06, and they stuck it out in Anaheim, you know, instead of in Jersey or New York City or Philly or something like that, where people cared about ECW. And, you know, again, it could have gotten over somewhere and it may not have in the other place, but at least put yourself in the best position to succeed. And they clearly didn't on that night for whatever reason. They put them out there in Tacoma, about as far from Atlanta as you could get. And even if they were hot, you know, back in the day, and yeah, sure, they ran Boise and Fargo and everything else. But, you know, by 01 with Buff Bagwell and Booker T, I just don't think that was going to be a huge hit out in Washington, the way they were presented at that point.
I just think that WWE at the time, I'm sorry I'm monopolizing the segment, but
no,
I don't think WWE at the time felt that the audience would turn on it because it was a WWE product. Hey, trust us.
Right, yeah,
we're going to give you this. Like we said earlier in the show, they had built up enough goodwill where you're going to forgive some transgressions, right? So
right.
Trust us. Hey, we're gonna debut this new product, this WCW product. Give it a shot. You know, now there might be a problem with that. I just don't think that, you know, like hell. I mean, they used to do Super Bowl in San Francisco every year.
Right.
You know, so I mean, if they do it in San Francisco and it bombs, did it bomb because the match sucked? I think that's kind of why it bombed, because I think that's another thing we've seen too. Matches start off dead, and the wrestlers pay attention to the crowd. And they get the crowd going fucking nuts by the end of the match. So, you know, I blame the wrestlers on that one too. I don't blame the company. You know, I mean, you're taught and you get the crowd into it, you know, and build the match. They didn't do that.
They almost needed a wild, like, they needed an overbooked clusterfuck of a match on that night to get the fans into it.
You don't have to overbook it. You can just have some intensity. You don't sit there in a chin lock for fucking 3 minutes.
It was a very bland basic. It was almost like a match on a basic training.
That wasn't even like, there was nothing like positive about that match, man. I mean, and like I said, I don't blame necessarily the location. I don't even blame the company for putting it on there. I blame the wrestlers on that night, you know? And so that's just something I wanted. I don't know. It bugs me when people pick on the poor people of Tacoma.
Fuck Tacoma. That's what I say. No, I don't blame Tacoma fans. I just blame the WWF for putting it in Tacoma. Like, I just feel like they didn't give it the best chance to succeed. But let's move on because I want to hit one more topic before we wrap. And that is the last Nitro. Thoughts on how the show went, the emotions conveyed. Was it a fitting end? Did you kind of like the synergy where they started in a cool location, the Mall of America back in 95, and they finish out on, Club La Vila, wherever the hell they were, for spring break? Matt, what did you think of that final Nitro? Was it a fitting close to what WCW was?
I guess it was a fitting close, but I kind of felt like a lot of the emotions that they were trying to get you to feel were kind of forced because –
yep.
I mean, there was so much that they had done and kind of killed the company already that, I mean, it was just like, all right, well, I guess WCW won't be there anymore. So I didn't really feel connected to the company anymore. So, and I had watched WCW since I was a small child. So, that really says something when they have, that bad of a product and you're just not you're not even emotionally involved anymore. Even with the title changes with Booker T and Scott Steiner and even the Sting Flair match at the end, it just didn't do much for me.
How about you, Keith?
I tell you, I sure as hell wish that WWE would start doing shows from, like, you know, outdoor locations like that or the mall or something different to change up the – I think that's the one thing that's always stood out about Nitro as compared to Raw for me was that they weren't afraid to, you know, shake up the status quo as far as putting out a different looking product to freshen things up a lot of the times. But as for the show itself, I don't know. I was pretty disconnected from it by then, like everybody else, I'm sure. You know, like you have aging Sting and Flair out there in T-shirts doing, you know, their 5,000th match and Booker T winning the title from Scott Steiner because he's the only one who was going to be signing with WWF and everybody knew it. And the cruiserweights going out there to die at the beginning, and none of them getting jobs except for like Hurricane Helms, who got turned into a cartoon character afterwards. And it's kind of summed up WCW. You know, quote Marge Simpson: "It was an ending, and sometimes that's enough."
What did you think of? I like that. What did you think of the professionalism by Tony and Scott Hudson to go along with everything? To play ball, especially like Tony. I mean, I know Scott thought maybe he had a chance. And actually, I guess when we talked to him, too many Scotts involved there, Scolo. When we talked to Scott Hudson, he made it seem like he wasn't really looking or thinking of the job, right? They came to him a couple weeks later and asked him to come in. So the two of them, you know, they played it pretty straight on a night where they kind of really let loose and let some things fly. And I thought Tony did an admirable job. He took the one shot at Regal, and that's like his Regal took a shot at them. But other than that, I thought he played it pretty down the middle for a guy who had to know he wasn't going to get a gig. I mean, he couldn't have honestly thought they were going to bring him in at that point. Were you kind of, I don't mean to say impressed, but were you surprised by that, Scott, Keith?
Me? Yeah, Tony had checked out a while ago before that too, obviously. And I mean, he knew he had his baseball gig coming up. So, I mean, I think, you know, he's a pro. He's always said that the Mick Foley thing was, you know, people giving him orders from on high, and it never came from any kind of personal place on his part. And I think you could tell that. And it's like he was feeling melancholy, just like everybody else at the time, and knew it was the end. So, you know, what's the purpose in going out there and trying to sabotage things? And,
right.
And that, you know.
All right, Will. What are your thoughts on that last Nitro?
Yeah. Well, when I think of the announcers, I mean, I thought they were auditioning for a job, but you know, because I thought the story at the time was that Shane McMahon went in there and said everybody was going to have a chance. So, you know, thought they were putting on their best shot. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know them personally. Y'all have talked to Scott Hudson, so I have no reason to doubt his word, you know. But it felt like they were, you know.
Right.
And the show itself, it was just so surreal, you know. You could probably say that with the exception of that Shane Douglas Stasiak. Was it Shane Douglas and Stasiak who had a really bad match on that show?
It was Stasiak and Bigelow. They had the fight over the tattoo or whatever the fuck they were
fighting
about.
Okay. Right. Like, except for that, you know, which is kind of a shame because those guys were real hot in ECW a couple of years before that. But except for that, you know, it was just kind of like, even if the wrestling isn't what I would consider, like, good wrestling, it was nonstop wrestling. You know, it was just, hey, we're going to keep this thing moving. We're going to feature as many guys as we can. The guys are going to go out there, and even if they didn't work smart, they worked hard. And so you can give them props for that. And then the things with, like, DDP and Sting and everybody saying goodbye, and Ric Flair gives an awesome speech.
Yeah, his promo on that night was fantastic.
Yeah, and that's the thing you want to take away from that night, right? Hey, if nothing else, it gave us an awesome Ric Flair promo. And that's cool.
And then he
wrestled
in a t-shirt.
They let, yeah, well, I'm trying to look at the positive, man. I'm known for being too negative, man. I'm trying to be positive here. So I'm gonna end it at that, you know. Stay positive.
I do like how they had the synergy. They you know, started with Flair Sting back in 95, ended with Flair Sting. I thought that was a nice touch, too. Yeah, so that pretty much brings an end to what we had on our list of topics here. I think we covered most of them. Anything else you wanted to say, Matt? We'll start with you just about this time period. Any kind of closing thoughts on ECW, WCW, or where Dirty F was at that time?
No, I think we pretty much covered everything here.
How about you, Will?
Nah, man, I think we ran this into the ground just the way WCW ran my heart into the ground with all that bad booking and bad matches and bad pay-per-views and all that miserable shit and putting Vince Russo on my TV. What the fuck was that? Anyway.
All right, and Keith, we need you now to spend the next 2 hours rebooking the Invasion, please.
Oh, I knew you. You're all banned from my website.
any closing thoughts on your end, Scott?
No, it's pretty much what we covered. It's, yeah, it was a great time to be a fan of WWF and interesting time to be a fan of wrestling in general. But yeah, things kind of went downhill pretty fast there.
All right, so we'll go ahead and wrap here. Had a great time talking to you all. I think this was a pretty good panel we had, so I think we need to bring you three back again maybe when we hit the end of 01, and maybe it may not look at the Invasion, but maybe instead look at what went wrong at the end of the year heading into 02 and what could have been different. So we'll go ahead and wrap up. We want to thank Matt Petticourt, Scott Keith, and Will H. from PWO, and Scott and myself. We will be back Sunday night. We have our Old School Survivor Series roundtable. We have another panel coming in. We're going to talk about all things Old School Survivor Series. And then Tuesday night, we got headlines to preview this year's Survivor Series. So until then, this is the PTV Podcast. I'm Justin Rosero. That's Scott Criscolo. Please visit PlaceToBeNation.com, your one-stop pop culture home, and you can find all fantastic articles and podcasts you could ever want in the world of pop culture. So until then, we'll talk to you Sunday night.
Good night.